I'd like to call this April 5th, 2024 meeting of the Arizona State Board of Optometry to order at 8:05. Roll call. Ms. Becker, would you call roll for us, please?
Dr. Mastores?
Present.
Dr. Cullen?
Present.
Dr. Carpenter?
Present.
Dr. Brown?
Present.
Dr. Moffitt?
Present.
Ms. Galan? Noted absent. Mr. Hamed?
Present.
Board staff, Margaret Whelan?
Present.
Fawn Becker? Present. And legal counsel, Mona Baskin? Not yet, right?
Does not appear she's present yet.
Okay, noted absent. And Madam President, we have quorum.
Thank you. Agenda item C, board purpose statement. The board meeting statement of purpose, a license to practice optometry in this state is a privilege granted by the Arizona legislature through the Optometric Practice Act. In 1907, on behalf of the people of the state, the legislature created the Arizona State Board of Optometry to regulate the practice of the profession of optometry, issue licensure where appropriate, and in general, assure the public that the practice of optometry will be conducted with reasonable skill and safety by persons who meet the curriculum requirements to hold a Doctor of Optometry degree from an accredited optometry school. To enforce the Optometric Practice Act, the board reviews applications for licensure and complaints relative to the conduct of its licensed optometrists and is charged with determining if the provisions of the Optometric Practice Act are met. In addition, the board may promulgate rules and policies in conformity with the stated purpose of the board and the mission as mandated by law. As of January 1, 2019, all board meetings are digitally recorded with the recordings of the audio available to the public on the board's website under the consumer information link. Agenda item D, declaration of conflicts of interest, if any, for this meeting. Are there any conflicts to declare among the board members today with our upcoming complaints?
Dr. Mastores here. I have two.
Okay.
I've submitted to Margaret.
Could you please state those for the record, Dr. Mastores?
Oh, yes. IR number 202415 and IR number 202419.
Okay, thank you. Any other conflicts to declare?
Yes, Dr. Brown.
Okay.
I don't have it by the IR number.
That's okay.
But I have worked with in the same practice or side by side practices with Dr. Palmer. He Southwest Eye Center is right next to us, and he I know him personally, I guess.
Okay, thank you. Any others to declare? Okay. Agenda item E, President's Report. I have a short report today. Just a reminder that the Association of Regulatory Boards of Optometry, the annual meeting is coming up June 16th through the 18th in Nashville, Tennessee. Any board members who are interested in attending, we can discuss this later in the meeting. That concludes my report. Agenda item F, presentation on 120-hour course of study, the history curriculum in relation to requirement for licensure. Dr. Brian Mock has prepared a presentation for us. Welcome, Dr. Mock.
Thank you, Doc. Thanks, board. There's, I guess, some conflict or some interest in where the 120 hours came from. And I think you have the right person talking to you about it. I was the president of the AZUA at that time. It had to do with the first TPA law. And at that time, there was questions on ophthalmology about the level of education that optometry had. And the way to appease that was to have a certain number of hours. Nationally at that time, most states were going with either 60 or 80 or even up to 100 hours. And we felt that that was not going to be adequate here in Arizona. So we pushed for 120 hours. I went out and met with Dick Hopping out of SCCO. And he was able to put together a 120-hour program very quickly, which the plan was the minute the law passed that we'd have education in place and ready to roll within 30 days. which we did accomplish that. I'm not sure whether you need to continue the 120-hour requirement. There may be still a few doctors nationally that are not going to meet that requirement. So you may wish to consider continuing that. It's entirely up to the board. Any questions?
I suppose one thing I'll say is anyone who's not speaking, this is Dr. Moffitt, please mute your microphone just so we don't pick up extra background noise. And then where did the 120 hours come from? Is it based on kind of an average curriculum, or how did you arrive at that number?
Well, at that time, most states were passing their TPA laws with either 60, 80, or 100 hours. And we didn't feel that here in Arizona that we would get it passed if we went with, you know, the minimum of 60, 80, or even 100. So with that, we arbitrarily came up with 120 hours, which SCCO said they could expand their 100-hour course to 120 and meet our needs. Ken Johnson and I actually were pushing for 150 hours, but SCCO would not be able to come up with that program in time.
This is Dr. Mastoris. Do you know what other states, what their requirement is, or if that's a typical optometry school curriculum at 120 hours?
Well, no, the 120 hours is an arbitrary number. The typical curriculum in the schools is actually much higher than that. And the 120 hours was trying to appease ophthalmology with the current doctors that were licensed here in Arizona. Now, what other states are doing as far as continuing their education programs, I'm really not aware of. I know there's a number of states that have dropped their requirements completely because most of their doctors now are fairly young and have already completed their education. Someone my age or older, then it's a question whether you want to continue it on or not.
Do you have an opinion based on kind of current licensure, if those hours should be adjusted up or down?
Honestly, my opinion, I would leave them alone right now, because I think eventually you're going to end up having to do a rules change and eliminate that completely.
Dr. Mock, I think this is Margaret Whalen. I think the key to that 120 hours also is the 12 hours of pharmacology. It's mostly didactic education. And also, right. I'd like to state for the record, we will never appease ophthalmology, regardless.
I know that.
I mean, it could be 1,000 hours, but I think, so out of that 120, you know, as the director of the board and licensing, you know, we do get, like you said, varying numbers. We get 60 hours, 80 hours from the older curriculum, like anyone who graduated before 1985. Then the curriculum changed again in 1993 and then in 1999. So, I mean, would it be safe to say if we somehow in the future remove that requirement but kept the pharmacology portion as a requirement?
Yeah, the pharmacology didn't come in play until the second TPA law. The initial TPA law didn't specify a certain number hours in pharmacology. It just said 120 hours for TPA.
Got it.
This is Dr. Mastoris. Do we still grant separate like TPA versus regular license? Okay, because I don't have that.
No, but Dr. Moffitt, members of the board, the pharmaceutical agent certificate, that's our highest scope, encompasses the TPA and DPA. So we stopped issuing that separately back in 2000 or 2001. Right before I came to the board. So any of the doctors licensed after 2001 have to come in at that highest scope. We do still have a handful of people that don't have the PA number, so they either have a DPA, TPA, or nothing. But those are the really chronologically older doctors that don't have anything. Even older than Dr. Mock. So those people are rare, but some do only have the DPA still or the TPA.
That's true. Is there talk of eliminating that requirement completely, or is the board kind of feeling we'll just leave everything alone?
So we looked at sort of revising the language and trying to decide if that's still a relevant number or if we should look at that number and alter it. And for my part, I think looking at kind of the average curriculum for most optometry schools nowadays would suffice, I would say, you know, based on what that looks like. But if, you know, if it helps to have a certain pharmacology basis, I don't have any problem with that. You know, yeah, that's reasonable. So.
And honestly, I caution about opening the rules and changing anything only because ophthalmology may slip something in on you. So just be cautious. Just be careful on that.
Well, that's in statute. So it is going to take an act of Congress to do it. And that's where ophthalmology proposes us. So.
Oh, yeah. They'll shoot it down.
Yes.
this is Dr. Cohen. First, Dr. Mock, it's good to see you. You look great. And I just want to say, as someone who went through that process when it happened and on the board when Dr. Mock was leading our association, great leadership. And what he and Dr. Johnson did was move mountains. And we've all benefited greatly from efforts. And I thank you so much this many years later for everything you did to bring this about in our state.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would second that. We all benefit from others' work. And so I appreciate that as well. Any other questions for Dr. Mock? Does that conclude your presentation, Dr. Mock?
It certainly does, unless you have some additional questions or you contact me at any time if you need any additional information.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for your time this morning.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you, too.
Bye, Dr. Mock.
Bye-bye. Take care.
So I'll move forward to agenda item G, review, discussion, and possible action on investigative reviews complaints. A couple comments first, as this is a telephonic and virtual meeting, please preface your comments by stating your name. When referring to a patient, be sure to use their initials only. We have a lengthy meeting ahead of us today. I'd request all parties to keep in mind that their comments should be succinct and concise. And remind everyone that the board has already reviewed all of the records thoroughly. And so we are well aware of the salient information. We'll start here. Let me just take a minute and see who's present. So I understand Megan Gailey is counsel for Matthew Palmer. Artie Eves, I believe you're counsel for Amy Ketting. Do we have any other attorneys present? Okay, so I think we'll start then with agenda item G3, Matthew Palmer, IR number 202417. Can I have a board member summarize this case, please?
This is Dr. Mestaris, I can summarize. So IR number 202417, Dr. Palmer. The patient was seen on September of 2023. Patient is SJ, and he complains of improper fit of contact lenses for keratoconus. The patient states that the contact lenses took 9 weeks to come in and then another 2 months to get a second set. In that time, he tore his hybrid contact lenses. He also complained that he was charged for follow-up visits. He also stated some complaints about the power of the contacts. And that is my summary. Thank you.
Thank you. Is patient SJ present? Dr. Palmer and Ms. Gailey, this is your opportunity to address the board if you would like to do so.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. Just to be brief, as the patient is not present today, and first and foremost, I apologize. I've had severe allergies, and today it's decided to affect my voice and not have my eyes water profusely. So bear with me. It's been a rough few weeks, but I'll try to get through this as succinctly as I can. Dr. Palmer is also planning on speaking, but we did provide a detailed narrative response to the board regarding the patient's complaints. In terms of this particular patient, he did present. He was seen by Dr. Palmer. Dr. Palmer made recommendations for scleral lenses and forwarded that on so that they could be ordered and then have the patient come back to have them fit. At no point during any of the contacts that the patient had with Dr. Palmer's office did the patient indicate that he had ripped or torn his contacts at any point in time, nor did he indicate that he was concerned about the delay in getting the contacts. With respect to the patient's complaints regarding being charged for follow-up visits and the initial follow-up visit for his first fitting, he was not charged for that. Dr. Palmer is an employee of a practice. He does not handle billing. He does not handle scheduling. Anything that would have to do that would be going through billing. If any of these patients' complaints had ever been forwarded directly to Dr. Palmer, or if the patient had asked to speak to Dr. Palmer directly, Dr. Palmer would have done so. In terms of the patient also had a complaint about, and it wasn't mentioned by Dr. Mastores, the patient had a concern about when he presented in February for his follow-up appointment. Dr. Palmer was out with COVID. He relies on the scheduling department to handle scheduling issues. They were made aware, they reached out, they canceled his appointment because Dr. Palmer was out with COVID. For some reason, unbeknownst to Dr. Palmer, and he has tried to figure out what exactly happened, scheduling gave this particular patient another appointment while Dr. Palmer was still out with COVID. Unfortunately, the patient showed up to the office and was informed that Dr. Palmer was not available. Dr. Palmer relies on scheduling to handle these issues. This was nothing that could have been changed, and it is very unfortunate. And Dr. Palmer feels bad that the patient showed up at the office. He let the staff know scheduling was aware. They tried to reschedule him and they were unable to do so. Based upon the complaints of the patient, we do not believe that this rises to the level of discipline, and we would ask the board to dismiss this case. One other thing, if the board in its deliberations brings up anything that we haven't had a chance to address in our narrative response, we would ask for the opportunity to do so. And Dr. Palmer is here as well and ready to address the board. Thank you.
Haley, Dr. Palmer, if you'd like to speak.
Yes, thank you very much for all your service and everything you do on the board. I really appreciate what you do to help uphold optometry here in Arizona. I also appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to, you know, as doctors, we really love our patients. We try to help do everything we can to help them in any way possible. You know, myself in particular, as I've worked with patients, I never wanted to see a patient turn away a patient because of like lack of ability or lack of skill or anything like that. And consequently, I've actually expanded my practice into, you know, prosthetic eyes or specialty contact lenses or other things. In doing so, I actually get patients that come from long distances. And in everything I do, I try to make sure that my scheduling is appropriate to make sure I'm not wasting time. People come from out of state to see me. They come from long distances. With the complexities of the visits, though, also come a lot of challenges with making sure the insurances are going to pay for some of these things that oftentimes are quite expensive. It can take up to a month sometimes for some insurances to even give their final or their first response, whether there's going to be an approval of a specialty contact lens or not. And that doesn't even include any appeals or other replies back to the insurance company to be able to make sure. So with specialty contact lenses, it can take some time. But like Megan said, at no point did I know that this patient was having a hard time with the time period. We discussed that it takes multiple lenses to actually find the perfect fit. He had been told that there was a possibility of having to have a corneal transplant based on his current contact lenses. So I wanted to make sure the contacts we were proceeding with were going to have the best health of the cornea and be able to avoid any surgeries possible. As it pertains to the power of the contact lens, those hybrid contact lenses are very different than spheral contact lenses. And as such, with base curves and vault and other things like that, the power of the lens are going to be very, very, very different. There just could be an optics a misunderstanding there as it comes to the patient's view of what contact lens power should be with specialty lenses. Again, like I would have done anything possible had I known it was taking so long for the contact lenses, and or even if I knew the patient was in dire straits. I have good relationships with my labs to be able to call them and try to expedite orders and other things like that. Again, I'm horribly sorry I was out with COVID. It was the second time I've had COVID. It knocked me out, and it knocked me out pretty much for the whole week. And hearing that he had come from a long distance and had to be turned away, I really, really disappoints me, and it makes me sad that happened to the patient. I feel bad for that. But I really feel like I've done everything I can and continue to do that for patients, not only this patient, but all my patients, to help make sure that they have not only great care, but they are also taken care of in every way.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Does that conclude your comments?
Yes, unless there's anything the board brings up that we could have a chance to respond to.
Okay. So this will conclude open discussion, and I'll open this up to board members for discussion. The board members may ask questions of the respondents at any point during our discussion, and so that frequently happens. You will likely get an opportunity to answer or to discuss with us. Comments from the board regarding Dr. Palmer's complaint?
Yes, hi, this is Dr. Cohen. While we can see clearly the source of the patient's frustration between the scheduling, maybe not understanding the billing, delays in getting lenses, which is not unusual, especially lenses, and certainly not understanding that a plus five lens and a hybrid may wind up being the same, provide the same vision as a plus two or plus nine in a scleral lens. And the unfortunate part about the scheduling that occurred with Dr. Palmer being out with COVID, I see no violation of the statutes in any way by Dr. Palmer.
Okay. I might offer some of my thoughts here real quick for discussion. A couple things that weren't mentioned. This patient also had what looked like severe optic neuropathy, right eye greater than the left, a history of steroid-induced glaucoma. I thought your care, Dr. Palmer, all looked really pretty appropriate as far as that went, with a couple of comments. One, he wasn't dilated. It was in the record that he refused dilation, but a patient with optic nerve damage such as that, I would think he pushed pretty hard to get them dilated or to have them follow up. Also, he currently used a steroid inhaler, that Advair, and knowing he was a steroid responder, I would be a little bit worried. I noticed you put him on Alphagan twice a day. I was curious why the choice of Alphagan as opposed to something maybe a little bit more first-line treatment and a little more thorough at keeping the pressures down. If you suspected a history, he was 47. If you were anticipating for a long life, right, of trying to control that pressure with as much damage as he already had. So that was one thing that stuck out at me. I'll give you a minute if you want to respond to that real quick.
Yes, I do appreciate you giving me a chance to discuss. I think the wording in my notes actually said the patient vehemently declined dilation. It wasn't for lack of like really asking and educating and the need for it. He was young enough. I was able to view the optic nerve. I was trying to do everything that patient would actually let me to do. Mm-hmm. They still have the overarching power to be able to say, no, I do not want to be dilated, even though I couldn't then refuse him. He has optic nerve damage and I'm trying to fit him with contact lenses. I can't refuse him care, but I definitely educated with him. Again, sometimes patients like this, I find that the more I build that relationship with them, I'm actually able to get them dilated later on. And he could plan to have a driver. I don't think he understood what that could have been coming from a long ways. But yeah, with regards to dilation, tried to do as much as possible and definitely picked up that glaucoma. Started him on Alphagan actually for a few reasons. Prostaglandins actually can be more complicating with scleral lenses in my experience. And although that would be primarily what I always start with, the Alphagan actually does a little bit better when I have patients that are wearing scleral lenses, even though it's more than just once a day and it's not just at night. So the redness from any prostaglandin sometimes can have those problems. That's why I went with the Alphagan route. As it pertains to the Advair, yes, that he's on that. The other doctor also was made aware. It was not documented in the chart that we discussed it, but he was to talk to his primary care doctor and review if any other options for him.
Did you send a note to his primary care regarding that?
I did not. I did not. That was a discussion in person. The patient canceled an appointment in December, a follow-up appointment on the glaucoma. And there wasn't quite the full opportunity to really vet out every need that the patient had.
Yeah. Okay. I had a few more comments. If that concludes your response, I'm going to proceed with a few more comments regarding the case. So I actually fit scleral lenses myself, And so I had a couple of questions for you. One, why did you decide to switch the patient from a hybrid to a scleral?
That's a great question. You know, the hybrid to a scleral lens was the specific reason I needed everything off the cornea. I didn't want anything touching the cornea. In my experience, the hybrid lenses have a higher preponderance of actually converting to actually corneal diseases or corneal transplants, especially when the patient had been told, hey, you're an impending transplant patient. I wanted everything off the cornea and trying to make sure I could protect it as much as possible. And also with glaucoma drops and the possibility of that actually coming down the road, I wanted to make sure I could have a nice reservoir of fluid and making sure that cornea was nice and healthy.
Okay. And then do you, when you're trialing the lens, when you try a scleral lens on the patient's eye, do you do the over-refraction yourself? And so as best I could tell from your note, you tried the lenses on yourself, and then did you do the over-refraction yourself as well?
I did.
Okay. All right, so that was my question. And then when lenses are ordered, you hand them over to a technician to order or an optician, it looks like, from the order form. You don't order them yourself at the lab?
Correct. I'll have my notes of everything I need to have ordered from the lab, and my optician will actually coordinate with the optical lab. I use Zenlens predominantly, but I have other vendors I use as well. Okay. But they'll review my notes with the patient's notes, topography with the optical lab. There are a few times with my consultant at Zen that they'll actually make a recommendation or want feedback, more feedback from me, at which I'll reach back out to them and say, hey, yes, I'm okay with not just tightening the horizontal peripheral curves. Let's do a bi-elevation lens instead. So definitely.
Okay, thank you. So the remainder of my comments here are for the board. As I was reviewing this case, here are a few things that I noticed. So in the records, at the first over-refraction, there was an over-refract of +4.25 and +1150 on the left eye. And then the comments, as far as the right eye went, decreased the sagittal depth 125 microns. Left eye increased the sagittal depth 50 microns. At the second visit, or just the first dispense of trial lenses then, there was an over-refract again of +6.25. So on the right eye, and a decrease of the note said to decrease the sagittal depth, excuse me, to increase the sagittal depth 200 microns. And on the left eye, over-refractive -2, decrease the sagittal depth 125. So here's what I think is relevant about that. At the first over-refraction, then your refraction was off by 6.25 diopters, Dr. Palmer. I understand that some of these patients are difficult. Like I said, I do this myself. That's a very large margin to be off on your refraction. On the left eye, decreasing it by 2 diopters, I understand that. Some of these patients are hard to refract, but you reversed. So on the first order, you decreased the sagittal depth on the right eye, and then you turned around at the first dispense and you increased it by an even greater margin than where you started. And so that's curious to me, why you would do that. The left eye, it's the same thing. On the first order, you increase the sagittal depth, and then at the first dispense, you decreased it by a factor almost of 2.5. So 2.5 times. This suggests to me that maybe the detail isn't there when you're assessing that first trial or even second trial. These numbers suggest that this is not a strength. And I'm trying to word that nicely. I don't mean any offense. It just looks to me like it's quite a bit off. I'll also say that then when reviewing the records, it looks like in the bill, there's an encounter for 12-12, which I'm assuming that was a contact lens dispense, but there was no record for that date provided to us. So I couldn't see if there was a second order ever, a second trial lens ever delivered to the patient, if he ever received his lenses, if he was refunded his money. I don't know if he has usable lenses or anything close to that, or if they were returned. The records don't tell us that. When I look through the record on the 913 order for the lens, the order is incomplete. So it actually says that the lab technician, the power on the right eye that's ordered is a -2. However, that was your trial lens power and you had an over-refractive plus 4.25. So if that's what was ordered, that might explain why you were off so much on the second dispense, or on the first dispense, excuse me. You remember you had a 6.25 over-refract. On the left eye, there was no power entered. And so we don't even know what power was in that trial lens when we're trying to look at it. So this to me suggests some level of disorganization and some breakdown of at least, at the very least, the ordering process, if not the fitting process as well. The records were incomplete. So if our job as the board is to protect the public and to look at the quality of care being delivered to the public, this doesn't look good from a perspective. I mean, this is something that the patient has spent a lot of money on, and then the lenses are grossly inaccurate. That's the best that I can tell from reviewing this record.
May I have a chance to respond?
Absolutely.
Okay. You asked about that 12-12. I think the opticians entered the information on that day. The patient was not seen that day.
Okay. It says encounter date. That's what it says, is there was an encounter on that day.
Yeah, the patient was not seen on that day. As it pertains to the contact lenses, as you know, fitting lenses, if the lens actually settles down the second visit when we had the first lens ordered, it can have a significant change in the sagittal height that you'd want to order, and also the over-refraction as well.
Yeah, I do. I would just say that you're supposed to have your patient sit in the lens to allow for that sagittal depth to settle. And so that's part of the fitting process, is to give that time so that that vault does settle. And I'm not trying to be hard on you, Dr. Palmer. I'm just giving you my honest opinion. I do this too, because I really combed through this.
Yeah. There could be differences too. I respectfully disagree. Like the first time I'm putting a scleral lens on a patient, it's a different experience. You know, it doesn't always have all the parameters I need for the lens to be comfortable, or even visually comfortable for the patient too. So the first lens, the first diagnostic lens I'm ordering, yes, I use a trial lens. I could just order it off of topography and OCT, but I'd rather have another glimpse into where we can be. So that first diagnostic lens really is our best or first step. Yeah, there's a big change, and that can happen. If there happened to be a little bit of a bubble under the first lens, patient having a hard time inserting a lens, again, it's not great to see an OR refraction that different, but at the same time, it can easily happen with the parameters of a lens and how the eye is doing. I think those were the comments I wanted to make with your comments as well.
Thank you. Okay. And I'll just say that I disagree, unfortunately, with some of what you said there. I'm going to pass the microphone now to any other board members who would like to address Dr. Palmer's complaint. Okay, so I'm going to ask specifically Dr. Mastores, I'd like your comments, please.
Thank you. Dr. Mastores here. I find that when fitting scleral lenses, it can be very difficult to put that into an electronic record. So for instance, when I'm fitting a scleral lens, I am like drawing pictures and writing all over the place, and that just gets scanned in outside of the electric record, because it's very difficult to input all of that. So I do think there is an art to fitting scleral lenses, and I believe that perhaps an electronic record is not reflective of the art that the doctor may have done. And I do think there was with the patient, they don't understand the optics of how it may come across. So if you see a prescription for a lens that's a scleral lens versus a hybrid lens, it's going to look grossly different. I think that created a illusion in the patient's mind that something was wrong, when perhaps the process of fitting was not complete. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Carpenter. I could say a few things. Looking at the overall case, I think, as was stated before, I think medically the patient was given good care. The reasoning to do a scleral lens, I agree with. My know, that was going to be my only question going into it. As I reviewed this, it was 2 months after the first visit in September before the first lens was dispensed. And then a month later, middle of December, there was that note that was not a visit, but it said that remake orders were provided. So it took a month, it sounds like, to design the next lens, and then another month before they received it. So that was my only thing, was to say, and again, I know scleral lenses, it can be a little bit muddy. These are difficult corneas to work with, but it seemed like the process could be a little bit more streamlined. And I don't know if there's too much delegation being done, too much being put on a technician to order. So I don't think there's any violations or disciplinary reasons here, but maybe just a good word of caution to look at the process and make sure that things are being handled as timely as possible. I know you mentioned, Dr. Palmer, that it can take time to get clarification on insurance and eligibility. I didn't know if that was part of the 2 month wait, if you're trying to get some things approved, but I know usually, you know, the patients know going in the cost, and usually they're just anxious to move forward. So I doubt that was the reason for the delay, but anyways, maybe just a look at streamlining the process and try to speed things up, because usually these patients are in dire need of something. And even though it may take 2 or 3 iterations, you know, the process could probably move a lot quicker. That was my observation as I reviewed it.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Mr. Hamed, any comments?
Madam Chair, hearing the case and things like that, I don't see a violation of the Optometric Act. I know it seems like the standard of care was not violated there, if you will. And some things occur, some things are not perfect, but it seems like here there is no unwillingness or malice on the part of Dr. Palmer.
Thank you. Any further comments from the board? Okay, so as my final comment, I'll just say that Dr. Palmer, I think your records need to be cleaned up, especially for this process. I agree with Dr. Mastoris that this... these are complicated. It's really hard to have. I also have a written copy and then also the electronic medical record sort of copy of these visits. But I would have found you on a record keeping complaint today at a minimum. But it sounds like everyone else sort of is willing to let this go. So is there a motion in front of the board? Would someone like to offer a motion?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I move that we dismiss the complaint as there has been no violations of the Optometric Care Act.
Dr. Mastoris, I'll second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint. Let's have a vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I vote nay. Motion passes 4-1.
Madam President, could you also reflect for the record that Dr. Brown recused from the discussion and vote?
Yes, Dr. Brown recused from discussion and vote. Thank you. All right, thank you. Let's see, so let's move forward since Mr. Eves is waiting with Dr. Ketting's complaints. Let's go to IR number 202418, Amy Ketting. Can I have a board summary, please, of this complaint?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I'd give a summary. The patient was originally seen in 2011 by Dr. Randall Tozer, who saw something suspicious, sent the patient to a retinal oncologist who felt that the nevus did not need anything at that moment, but needed to be followed closely every 6 months. The patient subsequently was a patient over at Riviera Optical and was seen a number of times in which there was no mention of the nevus either by the patient in the history apparently, or by anything during the exam. And Dr. Keating saw the patient, and for a visit in which there was no notation of dilation, the patient had refused dilation. And then at a subsequent vision, when the patient returned with a complaint about some loss of vision in that eye, found the malignant neoplasm, made an immediate referral to a retinal specialist and onto a retinal oncologist for subsequent treatment. And the patient has filed suit against a number of people involved in this, claiming that it had not been diagnosed in a timely manner. And there is also a concern in this case about whether there had been some modification of the patient records after the fact.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Is patient GC present? Okay. And then Mr. Eves, would you like to respond? And Dr. Keating, you'll have an opportunity also.
Yes, I would. Thank you very much. Good morning, members of the board. So I think that Dr. Cohen did a nice job summarizing this. You've seen the narrative that we presented. We presented you with all of the medical records and some additional records that you requested. So I won't do a belabored statement here this morning, but I would like to point out a few things. There, at the time of the diagnosis of this nevus, the patient was told to follow up every 6 months. He didn't follow up at all for something like 5 years. I think that's an important issue here before he went to Riviera Opticare. The other thing I'd like to point out is that every time this patient scheduled a visit with Riviera, he was asked by the scheduler whether this should be a medical follow-up appointment or an annual routine exam. Every single time he chose annual routine exam. As Dr. Cohen mentioned, every time this patient came in for visits with Riviera, he was asked about his ocular history. And at no time did he ever tell either of the treating optometrists anything about this serious condition with which he had been diagnosed and about which he had been told that he needed to follow up and take very seriously on a regular basis. There's no way that Dr. Keating or Dr. Blaskovich could have known about that history if he didn't tell them. And it's undisputed. You have Dr. Blaskovich here today. I see that she's here and present for the meeting. You have two optometrists here are going to tell you, both of them, that when they spoke to the patient about the history, he did not mention the nevus or the need for follow-up monitoring. We discussed a little bit in the last complaint, the issue of telling someone about the need for dilation. And I can imagine that's something that will be part of the discussion here today. What I'll say about that is that this patient was given a detailed discussion about the benefits of dilation by two different optometrists, both of whom are here today, both of whom will tell you that they went into great detail about the benefits of dilation. Obviously, because they were not told about his history of nevus, they could not have addressed that specifically with him because they had no knowledge of it. But he was told about the differences between retinal photography and an exam done after dilation. In each case, he refused the dilation. And we don't have to take the optometrist's word for that because there's an informed consent form in every visit that's initialed by the patient showing that he declined to have the dilation even after being informed. I think it's important to keep in mind in a sad case like this that although there is a sad outcome for this patient, what the first thing that needs to be determined here today was there a violation of the act by either of the optometrists who are here today? And so I would encourage the board to try to separate in your head the tragedy of this case when looking at the conduct of Dr. Keating. And if you look at the conduct in this case, what you'll see is that Dr. Keating saw this patient one time for a routine annual visit. At that time, she explained to him the benefits of dilation. And at that time, just like through the many visits he had had before, he said, I'm not getting a dilation. I refuse to do that. 10 months later, Riviera receives a call. The patient is reporting that he's having real trouble with his vision, comes in for an emergency visit. And at that point, Dr. Keating is the one who actually did diagnose the melanoma. She saw it, diagnosed it, and she had him in to see a specialist that same day. Within 3 days, he was out of state being treated by national level specialists for the condition that he had. Now, when it comes time to look at the damages in the case, I know that that is a relevant inquiry for this board. And one thing that I would point to is not only have I provided the standard of care review by the expert in the underlying litigation, I've also provided the causation review by a separate expert in the case. And that expert says that there could have been no change that was significant between the time that Dr. Ketting first saw this patient in 2019 and the 10 months later when she actually diagnosed the melanoma. So that will conclude my comments. I would also ask the board to give Dr. Ketting an opportunity to discuss and respond to any issues that are raised during this board's discussion phase of the case. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Ketting for a very brief statement, and then I think she wants to open it up to questions from the board. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Eaves. Dr. Ketting?
Yeah, hello. Thank you, members of the board. Thank you for taking time to listen, you know, and review this case and litigation. It's obviously been a really long and hard year. I've thought about this man and his family since the day I saw him and diagnosed melanoma. I had never seen melanoma, but I could tell you that the moment I saw it, I knew what it was. I was on the phone with Associated Retina that day, nearly demanding he be seen that day, not even the next day. As already said, you know, he was in, I think, at Mass General a few days later for treatment. But yeah, to be brief, again, I do feel I followed standard of care. I believe I had no idea he had any medical history, would have confirmed that. Seeing that he hadn't dilated in a few years, I'm confident I would, you know, it's documented that he refused dilation, and I'm confident I would go over all the benefits and all the, you know, downsides that things we could miss without dilation. So again, I feel like I followed standard of care, and it's a horrible outcome. But as already said, I don't think, unfortunately, the 10 months in between would have done too much for it. But yes, and I think that is it.
Thank you. So I'll open this up for board discussion next. Comments from the board?
This is Dr. Mastora. So the case is closed, right? The litigation's complete and there was a settlement?
That's correct. The case is settled. And that's how the case came to become before this board as a result of the settlement.
And did the patient litigate any other of these providers that saw him over this 10 plus years?
No, only the providers at Riviera Opticare.
Okay, so I think I feel that she was unjustly, she was the last person to see his eyes. And for some reason that patient, you know, chose to litigate. But it is the patient's responsibility. He knew he had seen, didn't he have the treatment for it in 2020? And then this didn't come up till later. I might be mistaken by that, but it feels like this is the patient's responsibility and that Dr. Ketting's already been through a lot. And I do think she tried her best, and I don't see any violation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mastores. Other comments?
Dr. Brown. This is Dr. Brown. I have a quick question. The word declined dilation and refused dilation has been used. As I look at the form, is the declined and refused off of the being determined because he did not opt in for dilation, or was there verbal decline and verbal refusal?
I think Dr. Ketting and Dr. Blaskovich can tell you about the actual discussions they had. What you're seeing, Dr. Brown, is the informed consent form, essentially, where he initials that he opts for the retinal photography versus the dilation exam. And so I agree with you if you're pointing out that form in and of itself doesn't say I refuse. But no, I don't think any forms are going to say that in most practices. Maybe I'm wrong. I think that it just shows you've been informed of these issues, which are pretty explained in pretty much detail in that form right there, you know, about the benefits of dilation and those things. And he signs off, I opt for retinal photography.
The reason I asked that question is because the retinal photography that he received was not close to what you would see in dilation. Your optos gets much closer to that. There's other photographs. And so as I read through that opting out or not opting in, it wasn't clear to me reading it that by taking photos, I'm still leaving a lot on the table. So that's why I'm asking the question about the conversations that were held with doctors and patient, because from the form, if I looked at it and I saw retinal photos and I think, oh, well, that must be similar, somewhat equivalent. That was my concern, is was there full discussion? Was there explanation that the photos don't cover? I mean, those photos, I don't know that they even hit 50% of the retina. So that was my only concern with declining and refused.
And if I may respond, Dr. Brown.
Sure.
I'm sure, I know you understand how informed consent forms work. And you know, oftentimes I get a lot of cases that I defend that are hospital-based surgery cases. And what we'll see is sort of a checklist of, we've gone over risk, 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 benefit, benefit, benefit. It is certainly not a reflection of the full discussion that is had about informed consent at that time. So I think we have a similar situation here. But I think the best person to address your question directly is Dr. Ketting and talk about what she told the patient.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say that we put all most of that on the providers. And obviously we have that conversation. And I stress that, you know, those images are very good at catching the optic nerve and macular pathology, but the entire mid-periphery peripheral retina can only be seen with dilation. We've since adjusted that wording, but we've obviously put that on the providers as the experts to, you know, properly educate. So I remember this exact visit of his routine eye exam in 2019? I can't say I do. But I can tell you the conversations I have with my patients when they do refuse dilation, especially after a few years.
And if I may add one more thing, this was after, I believe, 4 visits that he had had with Dr. Blaskovich, where he had had similar discussions. Sure. And so Dr. Blaskovich is here today, and she can tell you the discussions that she would have had with him about that as well. So you have 2 different optometrists who have attempted to educate him about the risks and benefits that go along with the choice that he was making.
I don't want to jump in on your time, Dr. Brown, if you're still talking. Good. So I find the paperwork lacking. It's a list notice of exclusions, and the patient is deliberately asked to initial that he'll have a $39 fee for a retinal photo. The retinal photo does not detail this is a limited photo, this is a 20% or just a fundus, just optic nerve and macula. When we do a retinal exam, you know, it's 9 views. This essentially represents 1 of 9. But I can understand. So from the patient's perspective, you have to assume that he doesn't understand the difference between a retinal photo and a retinal exam, and you have to go out of your way to explain the difference between that and document that in the record. And that's not done. I think you got put in a difficult situation, Dr. Ketting. You only saw the patient 1 time, and then at the next visit, he had vision loss. And so I wouldn't argue that you didn't perform standard of care. I would argue that your informed consent form is seriously lacking and needs modification, and that you have some exposure there. And if you want to inform a patient, you have to list things like, you know, a retinal photo will not evaluate vein occlusion, artery occlusion, an emboli, retinal hole, tear, detachment, choroidal melanoma, nevus. And even looking at a fundus photo like that, you're going to miss some glaucomas or even, you know, some macular conditions, because it's 2 dimensions, it's not 3 dimensions, it's different. And so although you can try to stand on that, you know, in a real discussion, other doctors know that's really lacking. And if you don't put that in the record, so if you don't document it in the record, I pulled up an article from the AOA, and I'm just going to read you part of it. So this is a February 14th, 2023 article that the AOA put out, 2 points to keep in mind when patients decline dilation. It says, while dilation is not required when coding for a comprehensive eye exam following CPT guidance, it is the standard of care. And it says that when the person declines dilation. If the patient refuses dilation, the doctor of optometry should first clearly and thoroughly document in the patient's medical record their reason for refusal. Secondly, a comprehensive eye exam can be performed over the course of multiple visits, so you should offer the patient a subsequent visit. All of this should be documented. And so that's how you protect yourself if you have a patient who, you know, vehemently declines. But that's not really reflected in your record. And so that's where I think there is some lacking and room for improvement. I also would not pursue this any further from a board perspective, as long as, at least from my perspective, you understand that that's an area that needs improvement in your practice.
Yes, I understand. So thank you for the construction. Mm-hmm.
Comments, Dr. Carpenter?
Sorry, I couldn't find my unmute. I agree with what's been said. I mean, my heart just, you read through this, your heart's just sick, you know, for everybody involved. And I feel awful for Dr. Ketting and the situation that you were put in. I agree that I don't think the board needs to take action at this point. I agree with what you were pointing out, Dr. Moffitt, about, you know, this just comes back to the age old, dilation education and consent and what, you know, how do we document that and how do we show that the patient understands? As I was reading through this and it was talking about the patient opted for photos, I was just scrolling down. I couldn't wait to see the optos to see what that looked like. But then I saw it was just this little fundus photo. And so, I mean, at least an optos can approximate more of what a dilation offers if a patient were to opt that. But yeah, the difference between the little fundus photo and what a dilation provides is so different that certainly, and it sounds like Dr. Kennedy said that you have already updated.
Yeah, I was just going to add, we invested in an IDIN. So we do have an IDIN at one office, and then we'll have the IDIN at the other office within this year, just because of cost. It really worked out just to get one this year and or one last year and one this year.
Yeah, so, but perfect. Yeah, I think that's the best thing that can come of this is just a reminder of making sure we see all that retina. But yeah, just a sad situation. I'm sorry for all you've been through.
Thank you.
Dr. Cohen, comments?
Yes, I feel like I've spent this entire week with Dr. Keating because I'm reading all the documentation, including the deposition. And I had a couple of questions about it. I'm actually relieved to hear the board focusing more on the issue of what constitute and record keeping or informed consent for the patient, because there is the question of standard of care. The AOA guidelines talk about, in one sense, dilation should be. Another part, it says it may be part of it. And we know where we always want to practice the highest level. But one thing, and I know, Dr. Keating, that a deposition can be very difficult. I was an expert witness once, and it can be a challenging thing. But you were asked several times about the patient's responsibility, and to my recollection, it was mostly, gee, I wish he had brought this up. Whether for you or your attorney, was the issue of contributory negligence involved in this because the patient never followed up on the 6-month visits and never informed Riviera Opticare about that? I was curious about that. The second thing with dealing with an issue, as I said, of omission and commission, the possibility that the patient wasn't properly informed. I think you did a stellar job once you did notice what was wrong to get the needed care, but leading up to that. And then this confusion about the CompuLink update and what carried forward versus the potential issue of a record being changed after the fact. So I was just curious as to how that all sorted out since the deposition and the settlement.
So Dr. Cohen, I think I'm probably the best person to address that, if that's all right. So let me start with the first question. Yes, contributory negligence was a major issue in the case, and it was alleged as a defense that the patient here had failed to follow up. And someone was talking about the timing of that original diagnosis with the nevus. That was actually 2011. And I don't believe this patient came to Riviera Opticare until 2015. So there were several years that passed between the time of him getting the diagnosis, the advice to see a specialist every 6 months, and then the time that he actually came in just for a routine eye exam. So contributory negligence was a major issue in the case, and that was litigated. Now, to refer to the issue that you're talking about the note, Dr. Cohen, I think it's a great question. It was an issue in the case. What I find in these cases is that many times weaknesses in the medical record system can be exposed only under the harsh light of litigation. And so in this case, what happened was there is a note in the chart. It's in, when I say in the chart, when I started doing this, charts were pieces of paper put together, right? And I'm sure you remember those days too, Dr. Cohen. And you could tell a lot from the chart, people's handwriting, when a new note was started, those kinds of things. These days, we've gone to these newfangled electronic health record systems, and there are a lot of benefits to having those. But instead of having paper as the medical record, these days we have a collection of ones and zeros. That's the medical record. And depending on which button you push and what report you ask for and which parameters you put for what you want printed out, different things are printed when you ask for a paper copy of that record. And I'm sure many of you have experienced that in your practices. In this case, there was a tech note that appeared in the chart at one point when the chart was printed out. At other times when this chart was printed out, that tech note did not appear in the printed records. So as you can imagine, the attorneys in this case were very interested in getting to know what happened with that note and why that note was bouncing around in the chart and why it appeared in some printed records and why it didn't appear in others. At the time that this case was settled, we were arranging experts to look into that issue. The case was resolved, and we never got to the bottom of that. So I don't have any answers for you as to why that note appeared in some places and not others. No one's ever going to be able to answer that question. What I can tell you, though, is that there was no evidence in this case to indicate that anyone had gone back after the fact and changed the record. That was not, there was no evidence of that in the case. I think there were questions about what happened to that record and why it was performing the way that it was in different printouts. But again, no evidence to support the idea that anyone changed the record. One last thing I'll point out about that. If someone went back to change the record after they got sued, probably the worst note you could put in the chart, you know, in terms of your defense of your litigation is something about a nevus. So there would be no motivation on the part of the providers here to put a note like that in the chart late. So.
This is Dr. Cohen. I greatly appreciate that update, and I am relieved to hear that because that was disturbing as I was reading that thought. I do want to say that for Dr. Keating, I feel for you. I'm sure you're looking forward to this being passed. I support the comments being made by the board, and in reading Dr. Messner and the other expert witness saying not only they felt that standard care was provided, but also that the likelihood that the cancer was actually there, even predating the time that the patient came to Riviera Opticare to begin with. And I felt strongly there is an element of contributory negligence on the patient's part. So thank you for all that feedback and good luck, Dr. Keating.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
I would propose that I also see, I wouldn't want to see any disciplinary action take place in this case, but I would suggest that from a record keeping standpoint, R421-305, at least that we send a letter of concern regarding a lacking informed consent and documentation in the exam note regarding a follow-up dilated fundus exam. Would anybody agree with that?
This is Dr. Brown. I would second that.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay,
Go ahead. I had a particular slide of everyone at River Opticare.
You know what, Dr. Cohen, you sound completely garbled to me. I don't know if that's the case for everyone, but I couldn't make out anything of what you just said.
Yeah,
you're still frozen.
Any better? Frozen. Okay. I'll pass.
Okay. Dr. Mestores, any comments regarding the letter of concern?
No, thank you.
Dr. Carpenter?
No concerns.
Mr. Hamed, any thoughts?
No comments.
Okay, so I would like to move that we issue a letter of concern regarding a record keeping violation and lacking informed consent, as well as documentation in the exam note regarding IR 202418.
I think you did that and I seconded it.
I kind of said it, but I didn't actually move. And so I moved.
Got it. Now. I second. I'll second that.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All right. So we'll vote. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestores?
Nay.
I vote aye. Motion passes. Let's see, 5-1. Thank you. So let's see, who else do we have waiting here?
Thank you, everyone.
I'm sorry. Thank you both.
Madam President, Dr. James Lewis is present. Dr. Madera, Elizabeth Madera is present. Dr. Blaskovich is present.
Okay. Let's try and get, we'll go back to number one, Dr. James Lewis, IR number 202407. Can I get a board summary, please?
This is Dr. Mestores. I can do it because I did the first time. This is IR number 202407, Dr. James Lewis, patient GB. The exam was November of 2022. Patient came in complaining of trouble seeing at night. Glasses were prescribed. The patient found that they weren't helping him or her, so they went back to have them adjusted. They saw the doctor again, had an Rx check, glasses were remade. Patient continued to wear the glasses without any help or relief. Went back to the optical and the optician told the patient to give it 6 months. Patient did as they were told and still have the same problem. Feel as if they paid money for something that did not solve their problem. Interestingly, patient said in her complaint that, or in their complaint, that they would have come back on day 59 had that been, you know, the right thing to do, had they known that was correct. But the patient is still feels they are out the money and has the same problem. Thank you.
Dr. Mestores, is patient GB present? No. Okay. And then Dr. Lewis, would you like to address the board?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Sorry, I can't get my camera thing to work. It's a new computer and I didn't figure that out. So I apologize that you can't see me in person. So
there's a slider at the top usually, Dr. Lewis. There's a little slider right above the lens. If you just slide.
Oh. Thank you.
Go, Mark.
Learn something new every day. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to meet with me. I apologize that I was not there in December. I read the letter as you can come to the meeting if you want or not. It's voluntarily. I wish I would have come to the one in December. So then this could have been resolved a little bit faster. I'll tell you what I know about the case. I no longer live in Arizona. I work for the federal government and at a community health center in Pasco, Washington now. So I don't remember a ton about the case, but back in October, I believe is when the complaint came through. So it'd been about a year. And so of course I looked at my records and tried to familiarize myself with them, because I hadn't left yet then. And if I remember correctly, it was a very, very, very small prescription. The spherical equivalent was zero. 20/20 vision. We did dilate. I dilate every patient every visit, whether they want it or not. If they don't want it, they can find a different provider. Anyways, I did prescribe, very small prescription, hoping that it would help them with nighttime driving. Sometimes people are very sensitive to even quarter changes. And if I remember correctly, I think there was about a half a diopter still. I can't remember exactly. But and then that was the first time I ever saw the patient. The second time he came back, I believe 1 month later, and we did an RX check. And I think I took out the sphere by a quarter. So now all that was there was astigmatism. And then sent him on his way. Unfortunately, that was the last I ever heard from the patient until the complaint came in the following October, so about a year later. When I received the complaint, I wanted to make things right. So I instructed my my office manager to reach out to the patient and refund him the money. That's the first thing I wanted to make sure, that no amount of money is worth a patient that's unhappy to me. It's just not worth it. She did that, I was told. However, she has since died of cancer. So I have no way of knowing 100% if that was, she told me it was done, the refund was made, but I don't know. I'm not 100% sure. And she was right in the middle of severe cancer treatment at the time. So I'm not sure if that was taken care of, if that was done. I don't know a ton about the case. I wish I could give you more details about it. All I knew is what looking at my records, and I've come to know that the hardest prescription to prescribe is sometimes those really, really small ones. And I guess I wish I would have had the opportunity to visit with the patient and talk. I don't even know if it's a girl or a boy, talk with them and try to resolve the concern before the complaint. Now, as far as the optical goes, I will admit I was I knew a lot more about the optical before we sold our practice to an equity firm. And I was much more in tune with everything that the opticians were doing. And but since then, I don't always know exactly what's happening in the optical. I don't believe that we have an optician that would tell a person to wait 6 months, because we all know there's warranties involved, and it's a lot easier to fix something in a month or two than it is 6 months, because warranties are, so I'm not 100% sure all the conversations, but nothing was ever brought to my attention as the doctor. It's unfortunate, and I respect the person. I don't want to take it lightly. He obviously, or she feels that they were taken advantage of, and I don't want anyone to feel that way. So I'm deeply sorry for that. But I don't even have any ability to look at the record now. It's my understanding that they've switched EMRs since I've been gone and are going with something completely different. So, and of course I don't have access to all that stuff anymore because I work somewhere else. So yeah, I'll take any questions from the board, if that's okay.
So Dr. Lewis, we'll probably close open discussion and open it up for board discussion. And then if we have individual questions for you,
okay,
then we'll do it that way.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Dr. Lewis. Let's open this up for board discussion then.
Yes, this is Dr. Cohn. Can you hear me now? Am I garbled?
Yep, you're good.
Okay, thank you. There was only one area of concern. Certainly, I agree with Dr. Lewis said that sometimes those very mild prescriptions could be the most challenging. But when someone's complaining about night vision issues with what is a pretty significantly minimal prescription, What did you have any discussion or do any testing or plan any testing to see if it was an underlying dry eye problem that's called a night vision issue, particularly since in the history, it says no ocular history except dry eye syndrome, because the issue may not have been refractive. It could have been tear quality contributing. Did that, do you recall anything about coming up, or is that something that you look at when trying to troubleshoot a problem with night vision?
I do not recall specifically having that conversation. I have that conversation 1,000 times a day, it feels like. But in this particular case, I would be lying if I recall any specific incidents. I don't know. But I do a thorough slit lamp exam. And I can't comment on that because I would just be speculating and I don't want to speculate.
Okay, thank you very much.
Other comments from the board?
Dr. Brown, I'll make the same observation I think I made last time, which is the patient did state that they would have been there on day 59 if it had been a 60-day policy, yet with her understanding of it being a six-month policy, she showed up at 8 months. So I don't find any violation of the optometry activity.
This is Dr. Carpenter. One question I did have is if it was ever resolved, was money refunded? And it sounds like it was, from what you're saying, Dr. Lewis. Observations were made that with such a small prescription, maybe we could have suspected something different. But I've prescribed small amounts of cylinder to see if it would help with night driving. I think sometimes when patients hear about an anti-reflective lens in glasses, they say, well, that's what I need because I see reflections at night, and they don't understand that that's really just to combat induced refractions from having a lens in front of you, right? And so having realistic expectations, it's tough. You know, some people kind of want to get a pair of glasses, you know, and they just want to have them, and even if it's such a small prescription, they're willing to try it. So but anyways, it was resolved. I don't see any violations here. I think we can dismiss this.
Any other comments?
This is Dr. Mastores. I agree, and I would like to say a motion to dismiss this case for no violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you. Second.
This is Dr. Cohen. I'll second that.
Thank you. Any further discussion? My only comment, I'll just insert it right here for you, Dr. Lewis, is that if I'm writing a prescription that's so small like that, I might put in the record, you know, patient advised, I don't believe that this is going to address their problem, but they, you know, elected. So that way everyone knows, you know, that you did say, I don't think this, you know, is responsible for your issue, but I'm happy to provide it, that kind of thing. So that would be my only further discussion. So I'll open this up for a vote. We've had a motion to dismiss and a second. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Dr. Lewis.
Thank you, everybody. Have a good day.
So let's see. We also have Dr. Madeira here, correct?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So I'm going to call IR number 202422, Elizabeth Madeira. Can I have a board summary, please?
This is Dr. Brown. Summary that I've composed is that the patient complained of delays in receiving trial contacts and being given expired contacts to help her during the wait for the ordered trials.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Is patient KM present? Okay. Dr. Madeira, if you'd like to address the board, this is your opportunity.
Yes. In the letter that I submitted to the board in her complaint, I wasn't working the day when this whole thing happened. I never gave her contact lenses. I'm kind of like at a I wasn't there. It was somebody else who gave her the contacts. The only contact I had with the patient was her initial exam. Went to look for trials. They weren't available. Took her out to retail. Retail orders the trial contact lenses. She came in, and that whole exchange, I can't comment on because I wasn't there at work that day. So somebody else had dispensed those lenses to her. I guess she used me because my name was on her prescription pad for her glasses, but I wasn't the doctor at the office that day. So I'm kind of at a miss of the complaint.
Okay. Does that conclude your comments, Dr. Madera?
Unless there's other questions that I need to answer for anyone.
Okay. Thank you. I'll open this up for board discussion now. One comment I'll add to the discussion. I did note in the records the patient wasn't dilated. There was no consent, no conversation regarding dilation in the exam, nothing. So that was one thing that stuck out to me. Also, as far as the ordering of trials and the delay in delivery of trials and that kind of thing, we're really at the mercy of the soft contact lens distributors. I don't see how Dr. Madera is responsible for that. So I didn't have any concern based on the case presentation, but I did have a concern regarding lack of dilation, lack of documentation, lack of informed consent regarding dilation in the exam. Other comments from the board?
This is Dr. Mastroes. My concern is that contact lens does not exist anymore. So she prescribed a lens that is unavailable and not patient can't get that lens because they don't make it anymore. And I do think that's the responsibility of the doctor to know what contacts they're prescribing and if they even are able to get them. So unfortunately, they had discontinued those oblique axes, especially in plus lenses. And so this patient has no way of getting that lens. And I do think that's an issue.
Can I make a comment? I'll just from my own experience, because I had the same thing happen to me. I've been prescribing the Activia Oasys for astigmatism forever. And then I got a letter from the company that all of a sudden they were discontinuing those axes. So anything ordered before that time, we didn't know.
This was after that time, unfortunately.
I just think that wasn't finalized. And so you find that out if you've prescribed something and the trial's not available and then you order something else. So I agree that it wasn't resolved, but I'm willing to give some leeway, I guess, in there.
The patient is without a prescription.
Right.
And they were prescribed something that doesn't exist. So that somebody dropped the ball on that. Somebody dropped
the trial. It wasn't prescribed, though. From what I could see, that the prescription wasn't finalized, was it? Am I wrong about that?
No, it was no
health record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Other comments from board members?
So this is Dr. Carpenter. I agree with, so I had observed some of the same things that were mentioned before. Sounds like this is more of a commercial establishment with different doctors in there. If they have expired contact lenses, I don't know what all comes under our purview, but my first thought was, who owns the practice? Who's in charge of maintaining those trials? They shouldn't have expired contacts on hand. That's an ongoing process that our staff works with, is throwing away expired trials. We try to keep trials on hand so that we can, if a patient's in dire straits, even if we don't have the exact lens, we've got something there to get them by while things are being ordered. Obviously, that's not being done. If most of what's there is expired. So that was a concern as far as how good of a service can they give to the public if that's how it's being managed. And I just didn't know, who's overlooking that or overseeing that. But anyhow, I don't think there's been violations of the Optometric Practice Act, but just some cautions as far as what, how to run a good practice, how to take care of our patients.
Any concerns from anyone else about the lack of dilation, lack of documentation?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I would hope that Dr. Madera, it's an interesting situation. I believe she's only at that office one day a week. It is not her practice. I believe it is a commercial setting. So a lot of the policies and procedures may not be in her purview, but I hope that in light of the discussion she's been privy to this morning, that she will be running back there at the next opportunity to talk about policies and procedures, standard of care, informed consent, and all of those areas in there. I don't hold her responsible for the issue of the diagnostic lenses, though.
This is Dr. Brown. I think it's important to document the conversations had about dilation and whether they're accepted or not.
Thank you. So do I. Mr. Hamid, any comments?
No comment.
Any other comments from the board? Any other thoughts?
I don't want to delay this, Dr. Masters, but those contacts were discontinued in 2022. And so I'm just protecting the patient here. She prescribed a lens that didn't exist, and that created a difficulty for the patient, and who, you know, maybe paid for a contact lens evaluation. I don't know. I do think that the doctor is responsible for understanding what is available in the lens. And then the dilation thing, that is unfortunately common in these types of practices, is that I don't know if there's a form they sign to decline, but it's quite common in a retail setting for patients to decline dilation. They might even have to pay more for it. So that's all.
Okay. So I, just for the record, I'll offer, I received like a letter a month ago regarding the Acuvue Oasys oblique axes that were being discontinued. So I'll just state for the record again, just because I think this is a fine point, that they weren't prescribed. This was a trial that was ordered. And even so that, you know, it's a problem, and I agree with you, it's an inefficiency and it's an inconvenience, but I guess I don't look at that as if it's a potential violation. So I'm sparsing those things. Other comments from the board? So I think that, and I'll state my opinion and let others weigh in. I think that a letter of concern, at least regarding record keeping and the lack of informed consent or dilation, is not in the record. That is Dr. Madera's responsibility to comment in the record why dilation was not performed and if the patient declined. There is absolutely no comment in that record. So to me, this is a warning to Dr. Madera that's at least at a minimum a record-keeping violation, in my opinion. Other comments? Agree, disagree?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I agree with that letter of concern.
Thank you. Dr. Mestores? We've been going back and forth.
I agree.
Okay. Dr. Cohen?
Dr. Moffat, this is Dr. Cohen. Quick question. You described it as a violation. Dr. Carpenter said a letter of concern. Could you be clear which way?
Yes. So I'm sorry. Just a letter of concern, a non-disciplinary letter of concern regarding violation of record keeping, in this case, regarding dilation and documentation of dilation.
Thank you. I agree with that.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Brown, comments?
I agree.
Mr. Hamid, any comments?
I agree.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes.
Baskin?
No, I can't hear.
Yes. Good morning, members of the board. I just wanted to be clear that the letter of concern shall advise the licensee of a possible violation and the board's decision not to initiate proceedings. And this is pursuant to ARS 32.17.4.4.E.
Okay.
Just to be clear on the language that the board is voting. Thank you.
I understand. Thank you. So then I would move that there's a possible violation of Record Keeping Act, let me just look it up, R4-21-305 regarding lack of documentation regarding dilation. Is there a second?
And that they be sent a letter of concern. Did you include that? I second.
Thank you. It should include a letter of concern. Any further discussion?
Yes. In the chart, I did put on there not dilated, limited views.
Correct, but there was no conversation documented that you discussed dilation with the patient.
I believe there was a sign-off sheet. Unfortunately, I guess it didn't get submitted. I apologize for that.
Yeah, I agree. It's not in the
record. Yeah, but you know, I'm not.
For future reference, if the board asks you to submit all records and then you don't submit all the records, we can only decide things based on what we've got.
No problem. I hear what you're saying.
Okay. All right. So we'll vote. We've had a motion and a second. Excuse me, Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestores?
Aye.
And I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Dr. Madera, for your attendance today.
Thank you.
So I'll go to IR number 202419, Dr. Catherine Blaskovich. Next, can I have a board summary, please?
This is Dr. Mestores. I'm going to recuse myself and stop my video.
Thank you, Dr. Mestores.
This is Dr. Carpenter. I could offer the summary.
Thank you.
So, of course, this is tied to Dr. Kedding's case that we already discussed regarding patient GC with the choroidal melanoma. Dr. Blaskovich, she saw the patient in 2016, 2017, and 2018, so three encounters for vision exams. And much like the exam that the patient would have had with Dr. Keating in 2019, there was no dilation. There was the same consent forms that we discussed at length regarding Dr. Keating. About opting for a photo instead, but it was a very limited photo just to the central fundus. And she was also a co-defendant in the lawsuit, and the recent settlement and judgment was also awarded against her as a co-defendant, and that's why it has come before the board.
Hey, Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Blaskovich, is patient GC present? Okay, and Dr. Blaskovich, I don't think you have counsel present with you today, correct?
Correct, I do not.
Okay, if you would like to address the board, this is your opportunity.
Yes, thank you. Again, thank you, board, for your time and efforts in this matter. Again, kind of some similar statements is an unfortunate case, obviously. But to say that I believe my standard of care was met in the sense that I had similar conversations with the patient regarding dilation. He refused. Again, those forms have been up for discussion. I will say just a thing about the form. I know there was question about it kind of having its issues. A couple things. The bottom line is yes, he never told me about any history of a nevus or any previous visits to other ocular oncologists ever. Obviously, if that had happened, things would hopefully have gone a whole different direction. But to say about the form, the interesting part of it on that form is if you see he refused or elected the photo versus the dilation, but in, I believe, the consent form in 2020, when he came in with a specific issue, knowing there was a problem, he actually did elect for dilation. So if that weighs anything. I, as you see from the my submission or submitted documentation, in regards to, I have a notarized affidavit from a EMR expert that specifically addresses the tech note to doctor, the Nevis note, to establish that that was not in the original 2016 exam, because that would, again, eliminate any potential that I knew of any history of a Nevis. So I have many questions regarding why there were two records, one with the note, one without, different print dates, quite many questions. And hence why I consulted with an expert to help answer those questions. And yes, we were on the path to getting an official audit performed while the case was still not settled. But when that was put in motion, the case settled within a mere few weeks. So that never officially came to fruition. Oops, there was a pause there. Yes, that, and again, as unfortunate as this case is with the patient's outcome, I did as much as I was allowed to do, given what he did or did not allow me to do, I should say. So that's my statement.
Sorry, I was speaking and my microphone wasn't on. Thank you, Dr. Glaskovich. Let's open this up now for board discussion. Comments from the board members.
This is Dr. Brown. I don't have any comments different than what we've discussed earlier, but I do have a question for Dr. Blaskovich. Were you part of the decision to settle?
No.
You had no say?
No, I had no say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other comments?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I think obviously the overarching discussion took place earlier, but in your response, Dr. Blaskovich, it caught me off guard when I started reading it, when you used the term nefarious about what had happened. In the discussion earlier, if you were privy to it with the attorney who said that a lot of it was, perhaps something in the phishing done by plaintiff attorneys looking for inconsistencies, and why would there be a notation about a Nevis, which would actually increase liability to the practice. Were you comfortable with the response given by the attorney, or do you feel that there still is something quote unquote nefarious about how this was handled?
I can't say for certain. Obviously, I can only go by the term I use based on if you have the, I'm sure you have the notarized affidavit with some main bullet points. Regarding specifically entry dates or access dates into the chart that correspond to some other things. Yes, I feel that there very well could be a question as to it wasn't there, how it got there, by whom. I mean, that would be for another day per se, but I feel I have some support, some evidence there by what I've submitted that says that maybe it was added at a different time.
Thank you. One other question, correct, you're no longer at Riviera OptiCare?
I have not been at Riviera since April of 2019.
And in light of everything that's gone on with this case, have you changed in terms of your policies when it comes to informed consent and recommendation dilation and documentation?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, different forms. You know, I think sometimes patients and we're all a part of this. We understand that sometimes people feel that, now granted that Topcon camera is different than the Optos, but still nonetheless, it's not a photography imaging is not a replacement for dilation. So I've been, having that discussion, had it before, but definitely it's much more involved. And with documentation of such, and yes, and, you know, the question comes up as well after, you know, how many refusals do you say, and fortunately it hasn't happened, or very rarely does one have to be, you know, dismissed, if you will, if the patient, you know, if they don't agree to follow our standard of care practice. So, but yes, to answer your question, it absolutely.
Thank you. That concludes my questions.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
I'm going to offer some comments and observations on my part. So I was surprised in Dr. Blaskovich's response, the argument that said that you offered standard of care. So in Dr. Ketting's situation, where she'd only seen the patient one time, and the patient hadn't been dilated, but was dilated at a subsequent visit, I felt like she had more firm ground. But to have seen the patient three times without dilation and without what I view as a reasonable informed consent to the patient, and they're being offered a retinal photo, the patient doesn't know what the patient doesn't know. And you can't assume that the patient understands the difference between a retinal photo, you know, a fundus photo and a retinal exam. And that's not documented. Right. So that's a big issue. We discussed that the informed consent really is lacking in this case. As far as the standard of care goes, had you dilated the patient in that 3-year time period, this would have been seen. And so the outcome of this, you can argue, may have been different. I think that melanoma was present. The whole time it's established in the record. I agree that the patient bears responsibility, whether that you were notified in 2016 or not. Pathology doesn't always walk in the door and introduce itself to you and say, hey, I'm here. Someone else diagnosed me and make sure to keep an eye on me. So it's also our job to diagnose, right? So it's, you know, I think that that's important. If you look at the AOA 2023 revised guidelines, it mentions in there with regard to standard of care that a comprehensive adult eye and vision exam should include. And among those things listed is a dilated exam unless otherwise contraindicated. As I referenced earlier, the AOA has an article out that discusses malpractice suits in particular, and that 45% of those result from misdiagnoses, and it's when the patient is not dilated. Again, it discusses the importance of documenting if a patient has refused dilation, that you comment in the record that the patient refused, why the patient refused, and to schedule the patient for a follow-up dilated fundus exam. So from my position, you have a poor argument that you offered standard of care. And I base that on the AOA practice guidelines. So I think that you've had a lot of punishment already. I'm not looking to punish you further. What I'm looking for from this situation, for my part, is acknowledgement that there was that there is room for improvement and that you change your practice going forward. And so that's what I'm looking for. I would say a couple of things with regard to the statutes, and then I'll pass this along to others to discuss. But it looks to me like there are some violations of the statutes. Number one, in 32-1701 G, any conduct or practice, including incompetency, that constitutes a danger to the public welfare or safety of the patients or the public. I think there's some room for conversation there. In addition, vision examination standards, R4-21-304. A licensee shall conduct an eye exam in accordance with the standards of care prevalent in the community and consistent with current industry practice. So I think there is suggestion at a minimum a violation of those statutes. I'll say again, I do think this rises to a disciplinary action. All I would be looking for, as far as my concern here, is a written reprimand. And I believe the written reprimand then would follow you, Dr. Blaskovich, so that in the future, if a complaint or other action came forward where the patient was being failed to dilate, and this was not informed consent, it was not documented well, then this would come up again. Those are my thoughts. Other board members.
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I have a question about that, Dr. Moffitt. You cited correctly the most recent AOA guidelines. These visits took place in about 2016 beginning. Is there a way for us to find out what the, if that was cited then, even though we look at what we would agree standard of care, that that was part of the established standard of care 8 years ago?
I think that's difficult. And I mean, we could probably research that. I don't, for my part, think the standard of care has really changed much. So,
yeah, while I'd agree with that, though, in your comment, you said based upon current standard of care and at least recognition that this was 8 years ago.
2015, you know, I think there's a 2015, I think was correct, the year for the AOA standards for adult, you know, comprehensive eye examination. I don't know if there was an intermediary one. Maybe, Margaret, do you know of anything such as that?
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. Dr. Cohen, to address your question, I have older versions of the AOA clinical guidelines. I could certainly take a look at that. I will try to do it while we're still chatting. And I was trying to also find what the updates were in the second edition that was released. Just like we do for our rules, a lot of times they just list the changes that have been made to the guidelines. So I will try and find that as well.
Okay, this is Dr. Cohen. To clarify, I'm not looking to be a stickler about it. It's just that, and I don't think that what we do has changed a whole lot over the last 5 to 10 years and what we're expected to do. But the point being that in Dr. Moffitt's comments said, based on the current standard of care, at least acknowledgement about the fact that this was not a current visit. This was, you know, eight years ago. So that we're not holding someone to the accountability of what the standard is now for prior action.
Other comments from the board?
This is Dr. Brown. I too have read the R421304. And I find it interesting. It says, in accordance with the standards of care prevalent in the community and consistent with the current industry practice. I know what the ideal standard of care is. But the statute asks for the standard of care that's prevalent in the community and consistent with current industry practice. As we see the things brought before us, I'm not convinced that all dilated exams for every patient is what's prevalent in the community and consistent with the current practice. I agree it's the ideal, and we do need to be documenting it. And I don't know how we're going to, how this weighs into this discussion, but the statute's a little, I read it a little differently than the recommendations from the AOA, which I agree with. I agree that we need to be trying to dilate every patient and documenting those conversations, but it says standards of care prevalent in the community and consistent with practice. And I would be really interested to know what percentage of patients are actually dilated throughout the state in the U.S. It's the one caveat I see in that citing. That's the end of my comments.
I appreciate your comments. I'll say a few things just since I introduced those two thoughts. One, I would say vision examination standards isn't necessarily the same as what, you know, maybe is done. So there's a difference there, potentially. But also the other statute that I noted, it's whether this constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of the patients or the public. And in this case, it's pretty clear that the patient's welfare was compromised, and we serve the public on this board. I'll also bring up 32-1701E. And this discusses our responsibilities as licensed in the state, but for ordering or performing clinical tests that are appropriate to diagnose, treat, or manage conditions of the human eye and adnexa. And so in this case, the tests weren't performed to diagnose, treat, or manage what was present in this eye. And so, like I said, I think that this is a harder argument for Dr. Blaskovich to make, that over three visits, the patient was never dilated. And I do understand if the patient, you know, declines or outright refuses, but I'm not left with any impression in those records that that's what the patient said. I don't see anything written that these are the patient's words, right? Anything along those lines. It's just really poorly documented. So this is the impression from an outsider looking in. And it looks to me too that you bear some responsibility for this being not diagnosed or managed. And so those are my thoughts. I'm not trying to be hard on anybody. I'm just trying to be fair to the patient and also to the standards of our profession. So those are my comments. Dr. Brown, did you have anything you wanted to say back?
Sure. The only other concern I have then is that we haven't applied, it seems, and I know there's three visits versus one visit, that there's earlier versus later, but I didn't see a difference in documenting. I didn't see a difference in documenting conversations in our previous case on this case. So I see, the only difference I see is here she saw him three times instead of once.
Right.
And so
I do. I guess given more opportunities, there's a higher responsibility. So I suppose that's how I see it, that over three visits that he wasn't dilated, if at any of those visits he'd been dilated and this had been diagnosed, the outcome could be different. I don't think the outcome would be different in Dr. Ketting's case. And so that's how I interpreted that. So I'm just giving my opinion, my interpretation. This is how I see it. I want to make sure all the board members have an opportunity to discuss this. Further comments?
This is Dr. Carpenter. Yeah, I think your comments and then Dr. Brown's comments are very insightful, Dr. Cohen as well. I mean, really, that's what it comes down to, right? Do we issue a letter of concern? I believe that's what we did in the other case. Or what was the wording, Dr. Moffitt, official letter of reprimand?
Yes, so it's a non-disciplinary action versus a disciplinary action. So the non-disciplinary action, it can be sort of recalled if that's relevant in the future, but the disciplinary action will have to be disclosed when Dr. Blaskovich, if she applies for a license elsewhere, anything along that, it'll have to be disclosed what happened and the board's response.
Just to clarify, you said a letter of reprimand will not need to be disclosed, right? Because it is not a disciplinary action.
Madam President, members of the board, if I may, Madam President, Dr. Carpenter, so you're talking about two different things. The disciplinary action is called a written reprimand. That is a disciplinary action that's reportable to the National Practitioner Data Bank. If the board is looking to do that, we would, I think, before doing so, at this point, need to get what the clinical guidelines said during the period of time where the possible action occurred. So because they were just updated in 2023, and that is what we are working off of, we really can't know what the AOA clinical guidelines were for dilation unless they haven't changed. But I actually am not sure about that at this moment. The other action that Dr. Moffitt was talking about is a letter of concern, which is a non-disciplinary action. It's not reportable to the data bank, and that is for possible violations. So when the board feels that, and Ms. Baskin had read earlier, when the board feels that there are some issues, but they don't rise to the level of discipline, it's a good way to, it's a good tool to use for up to put the practitioner on notice that if, you know, behaviors, policies, or other aren't changed, it could result in disciplinary action possibly in the future.
Yes. Madam President, members of the board, this is Mona Bafkin. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I just want to follow up, and I would concur with what Ms. Whalen said. We would need to have those AOA guidelines that were in effect at the time the conduct occurred. You could not use current guidelines and reach back and apply those to her. Also, just as far as what Dr. Blaskovich would have to disclose, as far as medical malpractice suits, those are events that licensees often have to disclose in various settings. If the board did issue a non-disciplinary letter of concern, just to point you to the statute, it states if violations, if the letter of concern shall advise the licensee of the possible violation and the board's decision not to initiate proceedings, it goes on to say if violations occur after the board sends a letter of concern, the board may initiate proceedings on all violations, including the violation that was the subject of the letter of concern, and it can be considered in future disciplinary actions. And additionally, if the board did indeed wish to consider a disciplinary action, it would have to be at this form of the administrative proceedings. It would have to be in the form of to offer Dr. Blaskovich a consent agreement for a letter of reprimand. And if that was not accepted, then we would have to move forward to formal disciplinary proceedings. So the board cannot unilaterally do that without having Dr. Blaskovich the opportunity to go through a formal disciplinary proceeding. Whereas a letter of concern, that is something that the board can issue unilaterally at this stage of the administrative proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Baskin.
So this is Dr. Carpenter. Yeah, so thank you for that clarification. I feel like with everything else that, with the lawsuit, that malpractice settlement, that is going to follow her around. I would be fine just with a letter of concern. She's already stated that she has changed, since this time, informed consent and how she documents. And so I think a letter of concern will be sufficient. That would be my two cents.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Dr. Cohen, your thoughts?
Yes, well, this is Dr. Cohen. I'm glad to have gotten clarification from Ms. Whalen and from Ms. Baskin because of the, it becomes easy when we look at things in current terms to not recognize that maybe like if someone had handwritten records in the past and now use EHR to held to standard from a prior time period. I don't know whether that's changed or not, but I do feel that in light of the litigation that will have to be discussed and that Dr. Blaskovich would have to be able to explain that in any future filing somewhere else, perhaps. I don't feel it requires disciplinary action at this point, unless we can clearly show that back in 2015, 16, 18, that the statutes say that dilation is considered the standard of care as they did in 2023.
Okay. Dr. Brown?
I would be comfortable with just a letter of concern.
Okay. Mr. Hamed, your thoughts?
Well, as a layperson here, listening to what's been said and stuff like that, and what's been read the documents and things, I think that that a letter of concern could do it. I'd even go, if possible, if the option was there, but I don't think it is. Ms. Baskin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think a verbal reprimand would even be possible if I'm correct. I mean, if there was a lower punishment, I'd rather go for that, but I could live with a letter of concern. But Ms. Baskin, is that an option or not?
I'm sorry, Mr. Hamed, I'm not too sure what your question is.
In terms of our actions here, mm-hmm. is the lowest form of action we could take is a letter of concern, or is there anything lower than that?
Dismissal is lower.
Right.
Okay, then I can live with a letter of concern. Then got it.
Right. Thank you.
How about also, so I would obviously I need to yield to the board on this. What about an order for continuing education? Do we feel like that might be appropriate? Some posterior segment disease, continuing education at a minimum in this case?
Dr.
This is Dr. Carpenter. I don't think that's necessary. I think the lessons that have been taught with all that she's been through, I think would do more than any, I'm sure she's had continuing education since this time, so.
Thank you. Dr. Cohen?
Well, I think there's always value in that. I would agree with Dr. Carpenter. I think Dr. Blaskovich is what this whole thing has done over this period of time has probably taught as many lessons of being as vigilant and thorough as possible. And I don't see where additional continuing education would make that point any stronger than what she's already experienced.
Okay. Dr. Brown?
I can't imagine the internal reflection that occurs in something like this, the questioning of your own abilities, your decision-making process. I mean, you get little scares in your practice here and there with something you think you might have missed. You look back, you call someone, but to have it actually come to fruition in such a tragic manner, this is the biggest life lesson you're probably going to get in this setting. So I don't know that anything we're going to do here is going to be any more than the lesson that has been delivered, as Dr. Cohen said. So I'm happy with just the letter.
Okay.
Yes, Dr. Moffitt, this is Dr. Cohen. If I might add one thing on a personal level, I spent a lot of time reading through all these documents, and I have to tell you, it scared the hell out of me. And it made us look at it. We have a doctor's meeting next week with my partner, my associate, just and our office manager, just to look at what are we saying to patients, how are we handling to go over this very issue. And that's merely just having read through these documents. So I think that it's a wake-up call for all of us, but I can't imagine it being a bigger wake-up call than for Dr. Keating and Dr. Blaskovich.
I agree. I think the malpractice suit is a significant punishment, so I'm not arguing that it isn't. For my part in this, Dr. Blaskovich, I hope you understand that saying that you did the standard of care, at least in my opinion, is misstated. And my goal, at least, is that going forward, you reevaluate that position. You know, we all just want our patients to receive good care. And if they absolutely refuse it, then you have to be really careful about how that's documented in the record about, you know, what you could do and what you couldn't do based on that interaction with the patient. So that's fair. All.
Yes, thank you. Thoughts.
Would anyone like to make a motion?
This is Dr. Brown. I'll make a motion that we send the same letter of concern that was sent to Dr. Ketting, I believe. Well, that we sent a letter of concern over documentation of conversations had and awareness of standard of care. Is that...
This is Sammy Hammond. I'll second it.
Further discussion? Yes.
Dr. Moffitt, yes. Members of the board, I would just defer to Ms. Whalen. Ms. Whalen, I believe that the board is attempting to issue the same letter of concern language that was sent to Dr. Ketting, and that's please verify yes. that.
Madam Chair, members of the board, the previous letter of concern was for documentation lacking informed consent and follow-up notes, in that case, regarding the fundus exam. Is that still what you want for Dr. Blaskovich as well?
That would be my motion. Okay. Do I need to recite it?
I think you're good. It's on the record.
Was there a second?
Yes, I seconded it. This is Sammy. I seconded it.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Further discussion? Okay, we've had a motion and a second to issue a letter of concern regarding Catherine Blaskovich, IR number 202419 for poor record-keeping documentation, poor informed consent. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
And myself, I vote aye also. The motion passes 5-0.
And Dr. Mastoris recused.
Yes.
Madam President, while we have Dr. Mastoris recused, I believe she's also recusing from number G to Dr. Klepfis.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I'll call agenda item G2, Jason Klepfis, IR number 202415. Would someone on the board offer a summary, please?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I can summarize. Dr. Klepfis, IR 202415. This is one we're revisiting from our last meeting, I believe it was. Complaint was filed by patient AR. There was an exam performed initially, was scheduled just to be a regular eye exam, I believe, to get more contacts on January 8th of this year. The exam was started, but Dr. Klepfis felt it was important to shift gears instead of doing the vision exam, change it to a medical visit because of some medical issues that he wanted to get cleared up before they proceeded with fitting the contacts. And so that was billed through medical insurance, I believe Cigna. And then on the 17th of January, the patient returned. At that time, the exam was completed. The optos photos were reviewed. The exam was billed as a vision exam at that time on the 17th to VSP. The patient raised some concerns about maybe being double charged for certain things, or maybe was there even some insurance fraud or impropriety there because two different insurances were being billed for the same services. I think the records show, and Dr. Klepfis' explanation shows that the insurance was not being double billed. The medical insurance was billed for the medical visit, and then the vision plan was billed for the vision visit. I think that the concern is in the records that were provided, if I'm correct, we only saw the records for the 17th. So we are asking for more records because there should be a freestanding record for both encounters if that's how it was billed to the insurance companies. And so we asked for additional documentation, and that's what we're revisiting today.
Thank you, Dr. Carpenter. Is Dr. Klepfis present? I believe a patient AR, are they present? Okay. So let's open this up for board discussion. Comments from the board?
This is Dr. Carpenter again. I don't think we had any issue with the care being provided, right? It was more the documentation of that other exam.
I agree. It was just we had a bill for two different encounters, and we were being told that they were billed separately, but we only had the exam note from one encounter. So then it did look like maybe there was a violation, but he submitted the 1-8 records, and so I have no further concern about this.
This is Sammy Hamid. I was looking at the documentation from previously in the current one. You know, some cases like this from a billing point of view, and all, as you guys, as DOs can understand here, is sometimes you have to bill, of course, one for the medical, one for the visual, or sometimes there's a primary and a secondary payer as well, and that happens. So you have to submit sometimes the same thing, and you let the insurances sort them out, if you will, or kick back what they will for clarification, things like that. And I think in this case here, it's pretty cut and dry and simple in that. I'll make a motion that we dismiss this and not find a violation of the Optometric Practices Act. And we can move on with this one.
Is Dr. Cohen, I'll second that.
Any further discussion? Okay, we've had a motion and a second to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Klepfis. Mr. Hamid, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. All right. Last complaint. Dr. Raymond Kellogg, IR number 202420. There was no patient present in this case. Is the doctor present? Dr. Kellogg? No?
Madam President?
Yes.
Excuse me. I would like the record to reflect Dr. Mastoris has rejoined the meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mastoris.
All right, a board summary, please, for Dr. Kellogg's complaint. I'll offer one. Let's see here. Dr. Kellogg had a license restriction from BIO, from the William Beaumont Army Medical Center in 2023. It also looks like he had a prior fine for not displaying his license in each of 12 different nursing homes in 2002. Dr. Kellogg has subsequently retired and is letting his Arizona license expire. Let's open this up for board discussion. Any concerns regarding Dr. Kellogg's, or any thoughts regarding Dr. Kellogg's?
This is Sammy Hammond. So basically, he's not practicing in the state anymore since he's living at LAPS. Is that correct?
Well, I think he's practicing. Well, he's not practicing, but it's his license hasn't lapsed yet. Correct, Margaret?
But he's living at LAPS.
That's his stated intent, yes.
If he's not practicing anymore and therefore it's done, I mean, he's been punished for his past actions. I get that already. And he's not practicing anymore. He's going to let it lapse. I can either go with a dismissal or, at the worst case, a letter of concern. But that's it.
Okay.
And the letter of concern would be lack of a better term. Just for the record, just to be on the record of his file and stuff like that. That's why.
Okay. I wouldn't even go for a letter of concern, actually, in this case.
You would or you would not, Dr. Martin?
I would not. I don't have any concern about Dr. Kellogg if he's letting his license go.
I know. That's why I said I can go either way on dismissal or letter of concern. Yeah. I can go either way on that.
I just don't want to issue him a letter of concern at this stage. That's my opinion. Other board members?
When does it expire?
July 7th of 2024.
Arizona.
July
7th of when?
2024, this year.
Oh, it's around the corner. Okay. Around the corner, all right.
I would dismiss.
Then.
I'll just try to get the other board members on the record. Dr. Brown?
So my only concern is that we make sure it doesn't get renewed. If we're going to dismiss this on the grounds that he's going to let it lapse, and then something changes and he changes his mind, then we've let this go. So how do we prevent Dr. Mastoris,
could we cancel his license today? No? Okay.
Because it would provoke a hearing under the administrative rules as a result of we tried that.
Yeah, that was a valid question, Dr. Mastoris. Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Brown actually said what I was going to say, and that is we can't preempt it just because he's saying he's not going to renew. We can really only say what's at the present and not what he's going to do in the future. So it's a valid point if the board has some concern that he may renew his license. I mean, people can say a lot of things and he's like, oh, I'm not going to renew. That's not really a valid reason for, lack of action. So I would suggest just taking action at hand. And if he doesn't renew it, he doesn't renew it. But the board still needs to consider, what's in front of them right now.
Madam Chair, Dr. Brown brings up a good concern. That's why I'm going to go back to my point. I think just for the sake of the record, as the totality, I think it would just be just for the lack of a better term, for the record, and also just for the public's point of view, I think it's better that we just issue a letter of concern. And that's that.
Okay. So noted. I would argue that we don't even know why this Army Center restricted his license from BIO. We don't have any information regarding why they did that. And so I don't think we have enough information to actually give a warning or have concern about his license. In my opinion, I don't know what constitutes that action. I don't know what interaction took place. And so from my point, I'm not willing to pursue any even non-disciplinary action toward Dr. Kellogg.
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'm inclined to just let it go, but Dr. Brown's point is a good one. Knowing that it's going to expire in July, if he were to reapply, all of this would come back up, right? And then we would have he can't just get a license, right, without approval. So if he indeed decided to change, it sounds like he's retired, but if he were to change, we could, this would all have to be reconsidered anyways once, when he reapplies. Is that correct?
Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Carpenter, that's not totally accurate. So a couple of things. Dr. Kellogg actually has a 5-year reinstatement period, so he can choose to reinstate. So if the board takes no action, there will be no action for the reinstatement. And also, if the board adjudicates this complaint today, that's it. So whether they issue a letter of concern, dismiss it, you know, take anything else, it would have to be at this moment. It would not be considered at a later date. Like, there's no holding pattern for these types of things. The last thing I'd like to offer. Yes, please.
I was just going to say, if he reapplies for licensure or tries to reinstate his license, does he have to disclose this disciplinary action from this other license?
He would at that point. Yes, Madam President, members of the board, if he lets the license lapse altogether and the 5-year time frame comes and goes and he's not eligible for reinstatement, it would be a disclosure at that time.
Okay. But not within the 5-year time period.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
I still stand by my point about I think a letter of concern, non-disciplinary action would be appropriate in this matter.
Mr. Hammett, could you clarify a letter of concern for specifically what reason?
Based on his background, based on his history, and also if we do that, guess what? In the 5-year time period, you just said right now, Margaret, that he applies for reinstatement, he can come back and say, oh, well, yeah, I had a complaint against me, but it was dismissed by the state optometry board. There's nothing there then. Whereas in this case, we can do that. And we're on the record just in case, you know.
Thank you.
Are you asking for statute or no? I thought maybe you were asking for reference to what statute might be in violation.
No, Madam President, I was asking because Mr. Hamid was just stating he wanted a letter of concern, but not specifically what it was for. You have to have a specific reason. We don't just issue like an overall letter of concern. It's for a specific action. So I just needed him to clarify what that was.
Okay. Right, right.
Okay.
And basically, in other words, Margaret, my objection is still continuing, as they would say.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam President, members of the board, and Ms. Whalen, I don't know if this would be helpful, but even though this license is slated to expire, and you know, you have pointed out that there's nothing to say that it cannot be resurrected, so to speak, would this be something to continue and make a request to him to provide more information so that the board could have more information to move on?
I would support that. And Dr. Brown, sorry, I apologize. I would support postponing it, tabling it.
Holding it over?
Holding it over until we have further information as to the disciplinary action that was taken by his employer.
This is Sammy. I can support that as well.
So we want to request records, is that it, or more information from the medical center, the William Beaumont Army Medical Center, if we can.
Or information for the disciplinary action that was taken against him.
Yeah, right. That's who restricted him was the, you know.
Yeah.
So right. Ms. Baskin.
Yes, and Madam President, members of the board, you may also ask that direct question to the doctor because he may have that information, particularly if there was disciplinary action against him. He no doubt has some documentation that indicates what it was, so that would give a starting point also.
So Ms. Baskin, you're saying we can do a request for disclosure from him?
Oh, absolutely, from the doctor, yes. Yes, and Ms. Whalen, do you want to jump in on that?
I'm sorry, Mona, you cut out. What was your question?
Oh, I was stating that the board could try to get additional documentation regarding this issue so that the board can can review it again at the next board meeting. And you can also contact the doctor and ask him directly to disclose, you know, documentation regarding this disciplinary action because he worked out what happened.
Yes, most definitely.
Okay, thank you.
Do we need to have a motion to table this and to move it forward, or can we close our discussion there?
You can, Madam President, excuse me, you may just table it with the directive from staff, which I do have noted that you would like staff to request records either and or from the Army Medical Center and from the doctor.
That would be lovely.
Okay.
Do we all agree? I think that sounds good.
Yes, okay. That's fine.
Everybody seems to nod at me. Okay. So we'll table the IR number 202420. Does anyone want to take a break from the meeting, a bathroom break at this point, or should we power through the meeting?
Bathroom break.
Okay. So then we can reconvene in 5 minutes. Does that sound?
Okay, 10:30 it is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
All these. Thank you. Welcome back, everybody. So agenda item H, review, discussion, and possible action on pending license by universal recognition applications. Applicant Stacy Romero. So it looks like Dr. Romero has a pending license application in front of the board, but Dr. Romero failed to disclose a previous criminal offense. Is there discussion or concern regarding granting Dr. Romero's license to practice in the state of Arizona? Failure to disclose, but we haven't granted the license yet. Any concern about granting the license based on this information?
Yeah, this is Dr. Cohen. The concern that I had was in her response, in which she said that she thought it had been expunged, and yet in the place where she put no, right under it in bold letters, it says that includes expungement cannot be used as the reason to write no. So I don't know if she was careless or what that was, but her rationale for not having disclosed it is specifically said that it can't be used as a rationale not to disclose it.
Are we allowed, Ms. Whalen, to require, because if this person is not licensed with us yet, our recourse is either, in my understanding, to grant the license or to deny the license. Can we grant the license, but then also tag on, for instance, like, a CE recommendation in ethics, something like that, which we've done before for someone who was already granted the license?
Madam President, members of the board, I would have to defer to Ms. Baskin on that specific question, but historically the board has issued letters of concern as part of the licensure granting process when the applicant has failed to disclose. So you could issue a letter of concern for not properly answering questions on the application.
Okay. I agree. It seems fairly obvious to answer that question in the affirmative. It clearly states, even if you believe it's been expunged.
Yes.
Further comments, Dr. Mastoris, your thoughts?
It feels like we're getting like a bunch of these. So I don't know if that needs to be like in bold, but it seems like the doctors that have had this happen to them, it's usually when they're young and dumb. But if you just disclose it, it's fine. So I liked that what we had done prior, providing an ethics course. I mean, I think anybody could benefit from that. So I'm not opposed to that.
Okay.
And this is
pending. It hasn't been granted. And so I don't know that that's available to us. What do you think of the letter of concern issue, tacking that along with their license?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen, and to what Dr. Mastoris said, if my recollection correct, it already is in bold letters, and it's immediately under the question. It's kind of hard to miss it. So I would look at it, and I'd hate to see this person not have an opportunity to practice and reading the details of when this occurred and their explanation. But I think a letter of concern is absolutely reasonable.
I agree with you, Dr. Cohen. Dr. Mastoris, your thoughts?
Yes, Dr. Mastoris, I completely agree.
Okay. Dr. Brown?
I agree.
Dr. Carpenter?
I agree. And not that I'm concerned they did something, you know, almost 20 years ago, but just the fact that they didn't disclose it. So.
Yes. Me too. Mr. Hamed, your thoughts?
I agree as well.
Okay. Would someone like to offer a motion?
Madam President, excuse me, before you do that, I'm not sure who that 480 phone number is. So if it's not Dr. Romero or Dr. Fisher, would you mind checking?
Dr. Romero, is that you?
Okay.
Nope, no comment. Would someone like to offer a motion?
This is Dr. Cohen. I'll make a motion that the license be granted, and along with the license, there'd be a letter of concern for inadequate disclosure in the application.
I second. Further discussion? Okay, so we've got a motion and a second to grant the license to Dr. Ramiro along with a letter of concern regarding disclosure or inadequate disclosure of her history on her application. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Agenda item I, review, discussion, and possible action on receipt of criminal background report related to initial licensure application approved under ARS 32-1730. Dr. Mark Fisher. So Dr. Fisher pled guilty to a prior criminal offense, but failed to disclose that when asked in his license application. His license was approved, assuming no prior criminal offense. Does the board have any concerns regarding this failure to disclose? So in this case, Dr. Fisher has his license, but failed to disclose the prior criminal offense on his application. Thoughts from the board?
Madam President, go ahead, Sam.
Yes.
Go ahead, Mr. Hammond.
That's very concerning, actually. He didn't do that, actually. I think we might have to consider the question of action now as a result of that.
Thank you. Ms. Whalen, did you want to?
Yes, Madam President, members of the board, thank you. I was going to say kind of what Mr. Hamed said is that this would be an opportunity to issue a non-disciplinary order for continuing education for some kind of ethics hours or something like that, or, you know, a letter of concern would be appropriate as well.
I agree. I think in the past we did 5 CE hours on ethics, and I think that's appropriate. I like that idea. Other thoughts?
This is Dr. Mastores. I agree.
Dr. Cohen?
For ethics class.
Dr. Cohen?
I would agree. I was just looking back over my notes about it. Yes, I agree.
Okay. Dr. Brown?
So I had one question. Did Dr. Fisher supply his detailed explanation of events or just the records?
Yeah, this is Dr. Cohen. I'm looking at it now in what he said. He explained it was his 21st birthday with some high school friends.
Yes.
Yeah, he did give that explanation. He
talked about being remorseful. Thank you. Yeah. I support what's being done.
Hey, Dr. Carpenter?
I support it. My only question, just to clarify, is the reason why we're doing the ethics requirement in this case, as opposed to the last one, is because the last one we did not have authority to do that because they're not licensed yet. Is that the only difference? Okay.
Correct.
Just to clarify.
Okay. Would someone like to offer a motion?
Well, I'd like to make a motion that we require Dr. Fisher that he be ordered to take 5 hours of continuing education in ethics, and that the classes will be at his expense.
Okay.
And Mr. Hamed, are they in addition to his 32 hours required?
Correct.
Okay.
Is there
also do I have to put what's the time frame on that, Margaret, for the rules?
Whatever the board pleases. Normally it's 3 months. It's 6 months. You could do 3 months in this case since it's kind of a shorter amount. It's really
at the
pleasure of the board.
I think 3 months would be appropriate.
I think 3 months sounds a little bit harsh, and I'd be more willing to give him 6 months to get it.
Okay, I'll give him six. That's fine. I can live with six. That's fine. 6 months is fine.
Yeah, this Dr. Cohen, I agree with that because he has to find the classes specifically
That's true.
In case they're not available.
Yeah. 6 months would be fine. That's fine.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'll second it.
Thank you. So we've had a motion and a second to assign Dr. Fisher 5 continuing education credits in ethics in addition to his typical 32-hour for licensure.
And the board's issuing a non-disciplinary order.
Sorry, non-disciplinary order. Thank you. CE. Any further discussion?
I guess this is Dr. Cohen. I have one quick question for Ms. Whalen. Does this assume now, could it be 5 hours online, or does it have to be considered live? Do we need to stipulate any of that?
Madam President, members of the board, Dr. Cohen, that's an excellent question. Normally it would be if it was a disciplinary process, but in this case, you know, if the board is willing to accept the regular COPE ACCME synchronous courses, I'm sure you wouldn't want asynchronous. But we could certainly specify that if you want to amend, if Mr. Hamid wants to amend his motion to include that.
I'm not picky either way. I'm fine. If he wants to do online, that's fine with that.
But I'm talking about synchronous versus online. That may have been prior course that just watches. Is that the issue?
Well, that's what you're asking. I think you're talking about the correspondence or the asynchronous courses. If the board wants to disallow those, you can. That's actually not my decision to make. It's yours.
I just don't know. I'm questioning whether or not we have to clarify that as in the motion for instruction purposes.
Well, I'm a big fan of clear motions. So, Mr. Hamid, if you want to amend your motion to include that it has to be a synchronous course or a live attended course, that would be fine. And then if Dr. Carpenter seconds that, we'll be in good shape.
Okay, I'll make a motion. I'll make an amendment to that motion that it could be a synchronous course, otherwise known as an online course, if that's acceptable to you all.
Dr. Carpenter, do you second that amendment?
I'm seconding the amendment, but I just want to be clear that it does allow for the online course, right?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Madam Chair, is that okay with you?
Yes. Totally okay here. So now we're ready to vote. Mr. Hamid, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. All right. Agenda item J, review, discussion, and possible action on pending license applications awaiting fingerprint reports, request for board approval pursuant to ARS 32-1730. So we have two applicants listed, Dr. Keila Barr and Monica Delacour, who are awaiting approval for their license, but we have yet to receive the DPS reports. So I believe that's accurate. Yes. Any concern about approving these licenses? I hear nothing. No discussion from me either. Would someone like to make a motion?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I move that we approve these license applications pending fingerprint reports.
This is Samuel. Second.
Actually, excuse me, Madam President. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Dr. Carpenter, you're not approving it pending the report. You're actually approving it under the statute. If you pending it, then we won't be able to issue those until the report comes back. Would you mind restating your motion?
So the motion is I move that we approve these applications under the statute.
32-1730, he means, right?
Yes, please. Thank you.
And my second still stands. Go ahead.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All right. We've had a motion and a second to approve Dr. Keila Barr and Monica Delacour for licensure in the absence of the DPS reports. Mr. Hamid, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Agenda item K, Executive Director, approval of new license applications pursuant to ARS 32-3123. So we've had three new license approvals between February 15th, 2024 and April 3rd, 2024. Dr. Corey Leach, Dr. Kinsey Frizzle, Dr. Madison Foster. Agenda item L, review, discussion, and possible action on approval of testing center for proctoring of jurisprudence exam pursuant to AAC R4-21-203C. So we have two locations Midlands Technical College Testing Center in South Carolina, and Omaha Public Library in Omaha, Nebraska. Any concerns approving these as testing centers for the jurisprudence exam? Comments from the board? Any concerns? Dr. Mestoris?
Dr. Mestoris, no concerns.
Dr. Cohen?
Dr. Cohen, no concerns.
Dr. Brown?
No concerns.
Dr. Carpenter?
No concerns.
Mr. Hamed?
No concerns.
None for me either. Would someone like to make a motion?
This is Dr. Brown. I move that we accept the Midlands Technical College Testing Center and the Omaha Public Library Resource Center in Omaha, Nebraska for testing centers for the proctoring of jurisprudence examinations pursuant to AACR 4-21-20.
That was lovely. I second. Any further discussion? Okay, so we've had a motion and a second to approve these testing centers. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0. Okay, agenda item M, Executive Director's Report. Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Our budget, again, the fiscal FY24 appropriation is $289,200. As of February 29th of this year, our beginning cash balance was $595,223 with an ending cash balance of $582,507. 66.67% of the fiscal year has elapsed with the board spending at 62.18%. I am still working to protect our account, our fund from the fund sweeps. And we don't have any further information on that general fund recovery that I was talking about at the February board meeting. So hopefully, I know the budget bills are gearing up, so we'll see what happens. I have a close eye on that. I have plans to possibly request salary increases for both me and my staff, purchase new computers, update the Thentia e-license program, and any office equipment before the end of the fiscal year, if possible. That helps to protect our funds. That also gives me the justification I need to ask for a higher appropriation. We have a healthy fund balance, so I don't want to damage that, but we also don't want the state to take it. So it's kind of the push-pull there. Staff activity since the last board meeting till April 2nd, we've had 98 renewal applications processed. 8 new applications have been received. 7 new licenses have been issued. There's been 111 phone calls answered or returned and 1,623 emails received and answered by staff. We have had 2 board meetings so far this calendar year. This is number 2. So remember, we have at least 6 per year, so we're right on schedule to have our 6 meetings before the end of the year. The legislative update, scroll down here. This year is the 56th legislature, second regular session, which began Monday, January 8th, 2024. Yesterday was day 88 of session. To date, 1,629 bills have been introduced, 896 in the House and 733 in the Senate. As of yesterday, 60 bills have been signed by the governor, 3 have been vetoed. It's been a really frenzied legislative session, to say the least. There are a lot of new freshman legislators, and I think this is the most bills that have ever been dropped in recent times by these legislators. So it's kind of perplexing. There's a lot of different bills out there. Some are similar, some are kind of innocuous, if you will, like just don't understand what their purpose is, but everyone has an agenda, so that's understandable. The bills that I'm tracking that specifically relate to us as a health regulatory board, I'm going to share my screen again if that's okay with you. I think you guys kind of liked that last time. Where's my bills? Bear with me. Okay.
Can you all see my report here? Hopefully. So starting at the top, House Bill 2050, Board of Psychologists Examiners. This is, again, it doesn't specifically relate to optometry. I'd just like to show you the types of bills that are in session for the various health regulatory boards. Some are driven by the boards themselves. Some are by the trade associations. Some are by the opposing professions. We all have one. We know ours. And so sometimes, you know, fun bills come through session. But in this case, this is about verification of documents regarding credentials. It has last action was transmitted to the Senate on February 12th, but it has not had any movement since then. Oh, I should mention before that, this will be helpful for you guys. The last day to hear Senate bills in Senate committees was Friday, February 16th. The last day to hear House bills in House committees is Friday, February 16th. The last day to hear Senate bills in the House committees, because remember, they all go to both chambers, was March 22nd. And the last day to hear House bills in Senate committees was also March 22nd. So keep that in mind when we're thinking about some of these bills. Just lost my screen. So Senate Bill 2072, Dental Board Testing. So this repeals their 24-month renewal requirement and establishes the renewal and certification process to run on a 12-month cycle, which I found interesting. You know, lots of boards have an annual renewal. We have it biennial. I don't mind it. Sometimes it's about money, you know, depending if it's too hard to manage a two-year cycle. That's a lot of reason that the boards will do something like that. So it has passed in the original Chamber of Origin, and was transmitted to the Senate on February 1st and has had no action since then. House Bill 2100, Administrative Completeness Review and Licensing, requires state agencies to publicly list on the agency's website items that are needed for an application to be administratively complete. Most of us already do that. So I don't know why we needed a bill to actually do that, but as you can see, this was a bill that was vetoed by the governor. Thankfully, the governor is a practitioner herself. She's a social worker licensed through the Behavioral Health Board. So she does understand regulatory and health boards alike. So some of the, what I would consider a little more frivolous bills, at least she's taken a hard look at. So keep that in mind when I start to get onto my other bills that I'm kind of worried about. House Bill 2114, Marriage and Family Therapist Endorsement. This is, again, a process we've had in place for a really long time, but we're an older board. So they're adding the endorsement process to their law. And as you can see, requiring a master's or higher to receive a license by endorsement. So that has been into the committee of the whole and the consent agenda and the Chamber of Origin in the House. So I actually don't see it, that it's been transmitted to the Senate. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to that yet. House Bill 2169, Barbering and Cosmetology and Massage Therapy Consolidation. So, of course, this is a very politically charged bill from the standpoint of massage therapy is fighting for their independence. And Barbering and Cosmetology is kind of wondering why they're getting combined with massage. I do think that Barbering and Cosmetology Board has fought for that for some reason, but it's a huge undertaking. Both are very, very large boards with tons and tons of licensees, like 200,000 or more licensees. And Massage Therapy Board comes with its own special issues. They have a lot of unfortunate, you know, sex trafficking issues, fraudulent certification, all that kind of stuff. So prostitution. So that's a kind of a very special needs board from the standpoint of they need a lot of legal help as well on a regular basis. It was removed from a hearing agenda. That was the last action on March 12th, and it hasn't made any movement since then. It doesn't mean it can't reappear later someplace else since the last day for bills to be heard has come and gone in both chambers. So we'll see what happens. If not this year, it may be reintroduced next year. That's what usually happens. Sometimes people will put a bill in, test the waters, see if it's going to get any traction or if it's going to get any support. And if it does, they may, even if it fails that year, they may reintroduce it the next session. House Bill 2243, fingerprinting, criminal history records checks, requires that when determining eligibility for good cause exception, Board of Fingerprinting staff can review an individual background. We do our own fingerprinting. The Board of Fingerprinting actually does fingerprinting for everybody else. So they do like corrections, juvenile corrections, teachers, all those kind of professions that if they don't have their own regulatory board would do that. They do employment background checks for employers that do fingerprinting. Excuse me. So this just sort of strengthens their law. But again, as you can see, it has gone into the Senate, but the last movement was on March 12th, so it may die if it's not already. House Bill 2279, Behavioral Health Professionals, Addiction Counseling. This is just sometimes the terms need to be redefined. That's why last year when we looked at our language cleanup, I know it was probably hard to maybe understand, or if I didn't explain it as well, I apologize. But this is a situation where the summary is, you know, that they're replacing psychiatric mental health with psychiatric and mental health, and substance abuse with addiction. So just updated terms for clarification. And that has to still go before the Rules Committee. So it's sitting as of March 26th. House Bill 2306, Dental Board Unauthorized Practice, permits the Board of Dental Examiners to issue cease and desist order on receipt of a complaint or otherwise. Again, our board is very lucky. We've had cease and desist in our law for a really, really long time, since before I got here. So that's been at least 20 years. Those of you who are politically interested may remember that Governor Ducey had a real problem with that. And we were ironically issued a cease and desist from issuing cease and desist through an executive order that he had. And part of that was actually due to the fact that certain boards did not have that in their statute. We've always had statutory authority. So, you know, that would supersede an executive order in theory. So this gives the dental board that authority. And it was transmitted to the Senate on February 5th, unfortunately, and has not had any other movements. So sometimes they're considered a little bit low priority bills, or they just hold a bunch of bills for the same board and they push them through at the last second. So anything could still happen until the absolute last day of session. Those of you that have been around long enough may remember in 2015 when we successfully removed the physician member off our board, it actually was heard in the Commerce Committee. Don Isaacson's pretty slick, so it died in our both of our committees, the health committees, and so it was heard in Commerce and passed. So that's like my favorite story of all time, mostly because you know why, ophthalmology. House Bill 2308, Occupational Licenses, Criminal Offense Prohibition. This requires an occupational or professional licensing board or a health profession regulatory board to review a properly submitted petition for review of a board's denial, suspension, or revocation of a license. This is kind of a big issue that was discussed. It's kind of started under Ducey's administration, and it has to do with boards denying licenses based on criminal history. You know, it's important that we protect the public, but I think what the governor was feeling is that, you know, boards are either being punitive or exclusionary based on someone's criminal offense. And then there's just a lot that goes with that, you know, when you have someone time served and all that kind of thing, because some boards have a very harsh law that says any criminal offense that's a felony, you know, certain types of felonies are like, that's it. I mean, we do have that, like sex offenders and things like that sometimes can create a challenge, but this was transmitted to the governor on April 2nd, and we'll wait to see if she signs that bill. House Bill 2312, Health Professionals Website, Time Limitation. So this increases the amount of time a health regulatory board disciplinary action against a licensee shall be available on the website to 25 years. This is just on the website. So our board holds on to disciplinary actions in perpetuity, and that information is also available as far back as 1907 when our board was sunrised. And so if anyone calls about a certain doctor, they are able to request any disciplinary action against the doctor from any time period. Right now there's a 5-year limit. That was a law that was previously passed, I think in 2018, where we don't post the actions. Some boards post the actions. I just have links to recent, but anything older than at this point would be 2019, we wouldn't have on there. So again, the information is still available. It's just whether or not it can be published on our website. As you can see, no action since January 22nd. House Bill 2424, licensed health aides, adds by affinity or consanguinity to the definition of licensed health aide as it relates to family members. It includes people who perform routine care under the scope of practice. Sorry, just lost my place. There we go. So this was transmitted to the governor. So it successfully passed through both chambers and was submitted on April 2nd to the governor. House Bill 2446, dietitian, nutritionist, licensure. The director of DHS is required to license persons who apply and possess all the qualifications required for the practice of dietetics and nutrition. So this is basically a sunrise bill where currently dietitians, nutritionists, I'm not sure what other titles there are not licensed in Arizona. So this will license them. And it was transmitted to the Senate on February 29th. It has not made any movement since then. So we'll see if they squeak it in somewhere. House Bill 2450, remote pharmacies, pharmacy technicians and training, adds a pharmacy technician trainee to the list of those that require 1,000 hours of experience in order to prepare, compound, or dispense prescription medications. So, you know, when you think about your optometric technicians and things like that, you know, this is kind of a similar situation where if someone came along and said, why aren't the techs educated in any formal way, this would be something that you would see sunrise. Excuse me. As you can see, though, it was not successful. It was actually removed from the hearing agenda on January 29th. So this one was already signed by the governor. This is House Bill 2473, licensure renewal fee waiver. It's now Chapter 37 of Laws 2024, requires the Arizona Department of Health Services to waive a renewal fee for an associate level license if the license submitted the required application for independent licensure. House Bill 2582, pharmacist collaborative practice agreements. That was transmitted to the governor for signature. So this is, as you can see, the provider definition has been expanded to include certified midwife or licensed physician. House Bill 2651, cosmetology required instruction hours. I believe they're actually reducing the number of hours from 1,200 to 1,000, from 250 to 200 for barbers, and that they have only completed at least 600 hours down from 1,000 hours of training in a school. So not sure why. I mean, there's a lot of health involved. I think people, when they think of cosmetology and barbering, you know, you're thinking, oh, it's the hairdresser, but I mean, they're touching your head, they're using combs, they're using clippers, they're using, you know, all kinds of sharp objects, and sanitary conditions are highly necessary. I'd like to see that when I go to my beauty shop. So I'm not a big fan that they are lowering the number of hours. And this one actually, as you can see, had last action on January 29th in the House and has not gotten past the second read. House Bill 2686, this is the bill that I had mentioned explicitly last time that we are not supporting as executive directors of the health regulatory boards, and that's all of us collectively. You know, when you think about osteopathic, chiropractic, medicine, nursing, pharmacy, we're all opposing this bill. This is a bill that Senator Bartow attempted to introduce about 6 years ago. It failed then, and we are hoping that it fails again this year. We met with Representative Bliss in January to voice our concerns and offer up some better solutions to this bill. And clearly those weren't taken into consideration. They did send over a revised bill, so I encourage you to look at the entire bill. The revised bill was still terrible. And all I mean by that is it protects the profession. It really is a friend to the trade associations and not to the state boards who are regulatory and who protect the public. So a lot of this, when you read the requirements, you know, it's like no anonymous complaints, how we have to handle complaints. They have to be within 180 days. If they're not, you have to write a full report to the governor and tell them why your board wasn't capable of adjudicating a complaint within 180 days. The investigation report is confidential until the end of the complaint. There's just all kinds of items in there that also the boards have no control over. Our board is lucky. We're a little bit smaller. Even though we had a lot of complaints today, that's really a lot for us, as you know. So we have no problem meeting 180-day threshold. But the big boards like medical, dental, nursing, osteopathic, even podiatry, when respondents are represented by counsel, that tends to create delays because they continue and continue and continue. And in the interest of due process, the boards will acquiesce to that request, but that does draw out the process. So, you know, the 180-day timeframe, I think, for the bigger boards falls short. And then all the reporting that's involved is very strenuous for staff. And the boards are already short-staffed due to the fund sweeps and everything else that are looming. So this would just be a really burdensome bill to the regulatory boards. So as you can see, it has the third read on the floor. So the bill is struggling. And the fact that it's gone to the floor for the third read is kind of a Hail Mary. So I'm praying that the collective legislators, you know, just don't even want to hear this bill right now. I don't have any other updates. I looked again today because, of course, yesterday I got on at like 8 o'clock just to make sure I didn't miss any late committee committees. So I'll keep an eye on that for sure. House Bill 2700, board members' qualifications and training. This is actually about school districts. But if any of you have children and you've ever complained about your school district board, here's your chance to take a look at this bill, although it's only had a second read in the House, which is the Chamber of Origin. So, but it basically is about education and experience regarding the board members. House Bill 2739, Homeopathic Board repeal, that bill was held. So again, that was another board that was in jeopardy of being consolidated with two other boards, Acupuncture and Homeopathic Board, and that bill has not gone anywhere. House Bill 2740, Board of Dispensing Opticians repeal. This bill actually is rumored to be started by Warby Parker, and it would either repeal the agency, which they just had their sunset review last year and were granted the maximum 8-year continuation by the state of Arizona. So to have it come back this year and repeal it is kind of shady from the standpoint of it basically repeals all their statutes and rules that they no longer have authority to do anything or and thereby not exist. Then there was some discussion about putting it under optometry board. No one came to me, but that's what Megan Darian, the executive director for that board, had mentioned. She had several meetings. As you can see, it's been held. I think it's dead. I'm hoping it's dead. But just for the record, I respectfully say I do not want dispensing opticians. I think it's a conflict of interest. Our mission is completely different from the dispensing opticians, and they should exist as their, they should continue to exist as their own board. House Bill 2829, Occupational Licenses, Apprenticeships. This requires a regulating authority to establish criteria necessary for granting licenses, certificates, or registrations through an apprentice program. It wasn't clear if this was all boards. I can't remember because I didn't look at the statutes that it affected. I apologize for that. But it hasn't gotten out of the House, so it's only had a second read. So without a third read, it's not going to move forward most likely unless they send it to the floor as 2686. On to the Senate bills. Senate Bill 1021, Scope of Practice, Process, and Repeal, removes the definition of increase the scope of practice as applied to health professional group, makes the section not applicable for regulatory entities who were legislatively enacted before August 7th, 1985, which that's us. So not terribly concerned about this bill, but she did sign it. So good luck to those people. Senate Bill 1061, Committees of Reference, Deadline and Extension, changes the deadline to hold a public hearing when a legislature is not in session to the last day of January after receipt of the preliminary sunset review report. This was transmitted to the Senate, and this is a situation where if the legislature can't make decisions on the bills before the end of session, there has to be some remedy. You can't just leave an agency hanging. Well, you could, but it's not really appropriate because all the agencies, all the statutes are set up to repeal an agency after a certain period of time. It hasn't had any movement in the Senate. I know it was just transmitted there on April 3rd, so I don't know if they're going to put on the calendar for next week. Senate Bill 1120 occupational regulations and complaints. This adds any city, town, or county to the definition of person for the purposes of defining the act as it relates to fraud. So the list, this actually just had action on April 1st. It was at the House Committee of the Whole. So that is the second chamber. So it's possible that we'll see that sent to the governor in the next few weeks if it continues on its path. Senate Bill 1163, homeopathic medicine qualifications, requires the Board of Homeopathy and Integrated Medicine to elect a vice president in addition to other prescribed elected positions. So again, this is a smaller board that was sunrised in 1991, I believe. And they just don't have the setup that most boards have. You know, we have a president and a vice president. Some have a president, vice president, and secretary treasurer. We're not that big of a board. So, and homeopathy is very small. So I'm surprised that they're really requiring that. But I guess you should have at least a president and a vice president. So in the like in our case, when Dr. Moffitt would not be available, then Dr. Mastoris would, you know, run the board meeting and be responsible for the decisions of the board. So that was transmitted to the governor on April 2nd. That's more of an administrative bill, so it's not a huge deal. In my mind, it's not. Senate Bill 1200, veterinarians, malpractice and unprofessional conduct. It expands their unprofessional or dishonorable conduct to include making a false statement concerning medical treatment of an animal. We already have that in our own professional conduct law. So this is just sort of the medical board catching, or the medical veterinary board catching up. And it does increase their maximum penalties to $1,900 from $1,000. We also did that about 5 or 6 years ago. We increased it from $1,000 to $5,000. So this is pretty standard. So hopefully their bill will move, but I can see that it's been held. Sometimes it gets held, even though this is a very like clean cut bill, it's pretty standard. But sometimes when it gets held like that, it's being used as a bargaining tool for something else. So hopefully if that's the case, it'll still move through for the vet board because they deserve that language cleanup. Senate Bill 1201, veterinary board complaints, records and specialists, removes the requirement that a member of the Arizona State Veterinary Board must be a certified vet tech and is currently employed. So this again is just moving around the requirements for their board members. Again, ours, we already have that. We all have that, but you know, ours are very clear, 5 professionals, 2 public members who have no association with the profession of optometry. So that's what this is doing here. I have no idea why this bill failed because it's, again, to me, pretty standard. But it's political. So at the moment, the bill's failed, so it's dead. Senate Bill 1233, chiropractic care, licensure and complaint investigation, defines unprofessional conduct and provides examples that would qualify as unprofessional conduct. So if I recall, this is just expanding their unprofessional conduct law. And also, I think Justin was trying to add in a little bit of that 180 days from Representative Bliss' bill, the 2686, to sort of preempt that. So that's what's going on there, and that bill failed. So I'll have to sunrise that again next session if he wants. Senate Bill 1249 was interesting. This is psychologists and prescribing authority. As you all know, psychiatrists are the only ones who can prescribe. Psychologists do not have any pharmacology training, but this would add the duties to the state board to investigate charges involving prescribing by a prescribing psychologist and recommending whether the medical board believes that they engaged in unprofessional conduct. It's super interesting. I would look at this bill just for kicks because anytime that it requires another board to look at your board's business, I don't like that. I mean, it kind of, we're all independent boards at the moment, and we would not want another board telling us what to do, just like we would not ever tell another board what to do with their people. There's a lot of commingling. I do understand that, but I think this bill is a little bit dangerous in my mind. Like as a director, I just wouldn't want to see that. And I don't know what benefit it really has to the public. So when you think about, you know, okay, the professions are sort of fighting with each other, but is it for good cause or not? You know, if it's going to benefit the public, then we should all work together. But I don't really see that here. It actually has not moved anywhere since January 30th and only has second reading on the floor, so it's most likely dead. Senate Bill 1267, physical therapy assistants, students in supervision. It removes the definition of student physical therapists and student physical therapy assistants from the list of personnel the physical therapist is responsible for. So currently, even though the assistants have a little bit of training or certification, they're not licensed like the PTAs are. So again, it's similar to like an optometric technician. And had a do pass recommendation in the House on March 18th, but hasn't made any movement since then. I think this legislature will be hard pressed to understand all of the assistant type personnel that you all have in your practices, not just optometrists, but every medical practice. There's a difference between licensure and certification, and then the education is a factor. So Senate Bill 1343, agency review rules and automatic expiration. Thank goodness the governor vetoed this. So this would require the use of actual impacts and costs from the last 5 years for the agency. Like, we are just inundated with reports as it is. So to have to like go through this process of, when it comes to the rules, like we're already still on the rules moratorium from like 10 years ago. So I'm really happy that this just was vetoed by the governor, because I just don't want them to touch the rules process. It's already cumbersome and time consuming. So happy that that one's been vetoed. Senate Bill 1507, transitional training permittees, medical licensure, relates to medical graduate transitional training permits. They're eligible for licensure as a doctor of medicine on successful package of the STEP program from the US Medical Licensing Exam with a scaled score. You can kind of see all that there. The bill failed, unfortunately. So I don't know if they were looking to expedite that process for medical assistance for the transition period, but it's kind of challenging when you have any kind of temporary or provisional licensure, even a transitioning. That's actually the first time I've seen the transitional license. so it's good. I think that bill could come back. I think it should come back. I mean, if it's necessary, because their process is a lot longer than ours. So I think that'd be helpful to medical board. Senate Bill 15, licensure eligibility and documentation, requires an agency to accept a federal tax ID number provided by an eligible person in lieu of a social security number. I don't have any heartburn over that one way or the other. As you can see, it never really got out of the Senate anyways, but I'm not sure what a federal tax ID number would be other than, unless they're talking about to me, that's a business tax ID. I'm not really sure. But it doesn't really show that someone is legally in the United States. Maybe it does. That's not my area of expertise. So, but I don't have to worry about it because it didn't go anywhere. And lastly, Senate Bill 1565, unfortunately did not move out of the Senate. So the bill is probably dead, but it requires a regulating authority to establish criteria necessary for granting licenses, certificates, or registrations through apprenticeship programs. Again, optometry does not really have an apprenticeship program, but it's just interesting to see all the apprenticeship discussion that's out there this session, and how it's going to start affecting the health regulatory boards. I can't see optometry having an apprenticeship anytime soon. I mean, and if we did, I don't think we would call it that. So again, that gets kind of back to the optometric technicians. So that was my report on the legislation. Future agenda items. I have one that I would like, and then I will ask if any of you, one that I would like to bring before the board is our jurisprudence exam, to move it to an online format in some way, if we could have that discussion at a future board meeting. I think our processes right now are decent. We put in our rules 5 years ago to allow them to take it remotely. That's why we approved the testing centers. But I think ideally, if we could have it as an online exam in some way, and Ms. Becker and I are still working out the kinks on that. She's doing some research on that. So I'll add that to the agenda. Is there anything else for future agenda items?
I thought we should discuss the salary and equipment review. When would we do that?
Okay, I can add that to the agenda for next time.
Any other future agenda items? Okay. Future board meeting dates. I have June 7th as our next board meeting. Is everyone available on that day?
Yes, I am.
Because then it would be June 7th and then August, like August 3rd, I think it is. This is my tentative two dates that I want to throw out.
Maybe the second of August.
I'm okay with June 7th. This is Dr. Carpenter.
Dr. Brown, Dr. Cohen?
Dr. Brown, I'm good.
Dr. Cohen, I'm okay with that.
June 7th, I'm good.
Awesome. June 7th is fine with me as well.
Okay, so Madam President, if we could do June 7th for our next meeting, that would be awesome.
Great.
And that concludes my executive director's report, and thank you so much for listening. I know it was a little bit long, but legislative session time always is a little bit, so, but thank you.
Okay. Call to the public. Any members of the public that would like to address the board? Motion to adjourn. Would someone like to make a motion to adjourn?
Dr. Cohen, I'll make a motion to adjourn. Is it still Friday?
Yeah.
Dr. Brown, I second.
Yes, it is.
Thank you. A motion and a second to adjourn. Further discussion?
Great meeting, everyone.
Can we vote on that, Dr. Moffitt?
Yes. Mr. Hamed, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
I vote aye, and I want to know if Dr. Brown read all those books behind him.
Dr. Mestoris?
I'll have a new picture.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 6-0.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
I not read those books.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of the day.
I need to say this. This concludes the April 5th, 2024 meeting of the Arizona State Board of Optometry meeting at 11:24.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Moffitt.
Thanks,
everybody. Bye.